Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Tommy Boyd.
Tommy Boyd on Talk Radio.
Sometimes not enough attention is given to important milestones in history, and I think one was reached today. And yet I only found out about it on sort of page three of one of the full what do they call them, the big paper news broadsheets?
Yeah, the big newspapers.
Yes, the important ones. So it's been reported, but I think it's absolutely huge. And it is that UKIP is about to cease to be, effectively. And I just think that its passing should be noted, but also somehow should be celebrated, regardless of what you might think about some of their policies and some of the characters who were involved in UKIP. They've made an enormous contribution to the history of this country. This country's a landmark was achieved 18 months ago, largely as a result of the work of UKIP. A referendum was held, and the referendum delivered the verdict that we should leave the European Union. And so Britain will never be the same again. Europe will never be the same again because of this extraordinary political party. Now, an awful lot of people have got no time at all for UKIP and damn them from every direction for a whole range of perceived ills. But the fact is, it did what it said on the tin. I did enjoy Nigel Farage saying in the European Parliament a couple of weeks after the referendum, when I arrived and I told you what I wanted to achieve, you all laughed. Well, you're not laughing now. And no, they weren't laughing now. So, Kath, are you aware of why it is that UKIP has finally been brought to its knees?
Well, yeah, in a roundabout way. It's words again, isn't it?
Words again.
Well, remember when UKIP was in its infancy and there was that plane crash because
yes,
they got caught up with their own words?
Oh, I see. Oh, that's clever. Right, so the message, I don't know what they were hauling on that plane. Was it Vote UKIP or something?
Something like that, yeah.
And got wrapped around the tail.
Yeah, and that's what brought the plane down. And now it's some ill-chosen words by one of their representatives.
Yes.
And their decision to back her in a libel case.
Yes, that's exactly it. I keep wanting to say Joan Collins, but it's Jane Collins. And she is MEP, I think, is it for Hull? Certainly it was in Hull that she made the offending remarks about three Labour MPs, knowing about some unfortunate events that had gone on and deliberately did nothing about it. Appears to be the gist of the accusations that were made. They took action against her. She ended up with a bill, a large bill, for expenses and also penalties. But the judge has just decided that UKIP's decision to defer payment until after the last general election, the snap general election, the judge decided was on the basis that they thought it would win them votes. And so I understand that the financial penalties for this episode are so great that not only might Miss Jane stroke Joan Collins have to declare herself bankrupt, but that UKIP may not be able to cover the payments that are required of them. And as a consequence, they may not be able to field candidates in the forthcoming local elections, because it's not anywhere written up in the British Constitution whether or not a party that is bankrupt can field candidates. You can't be a member of Parliament if you're bankrupt, can you? That was why Geoffrey Archer, I believe, left the House of Commons when he was made bankrupt, aged 12 or whatever it was. But, of course, nothing is written down in the British Constitution, so it's quite possible that there'll be a way around that as far as they're concerned. But their support is declining enormously anyway, simply because for most of their supporters, they have achieved what they intended to achieve. And so a lot of their supporters have deserted them and moved, broadly speaking, to or back to, depending, the Conservative Party is how it is. So it could well be bye-bye UKIP. And how will they be remembered for you, Kath, personally?
OK, let me be diplomatic.
Yes,
I won't give you the pub answer. A collection of characters.
Yes.
attempting to cobble together something like a respectable party?
Yes, yes.
A lot of the characters involved in it were not successful in mainstream politics before.
That's true.
And the reason being that they were characters.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've got people like Godfrey Bloom who...
Yes.
He made remarks like, this place is full of sluts. Do you remember this one?
I don't remember that one, no.
I kind of... when you
look, yes, I do.
It was at a conference, yes, where they were trying to encourage more women into politics, which sounds dreadful, right? But then you realise what he was doing was a callback to a remark he'd made at the beginning of his campaign where he said, I need to address women's issues. They don't clean properly behind the fridge.
That's the one. They're cleaning properly behind the fridge.
So he was at this conference talking about getting more women into politics, and a female... UKIP representative was talking about how they gave women jobs on basis of merit rather than their gender. And she said, because I, for example, never clean behind my fridge, which is where the sluts comment came from. He meant in a slatternly and slovenly way, the meaning of that word, rather than the sort of sexually loose way, which I think most people would take it to mean. So, you know, there were comments like that that would happen. And they would be seized upon by the press in the same way that the press in America seized upon the sort of things that Donald Trump said.
I was just thinking that they could be relied on to come up with something that would colourise a newspaper, a morning newspaper or a morning radio news bulletin quite frequently, regularly. They could be relied on to do it, just as Donald Trump can be relied on to tweet something that is going to be worth reading in the morning.
And back then, when they started out, just like when Donald Trump started out on his campaign for power, it was a bit of fun. These people had no chance of obtaining anything like a real say in the way we ran the country. They were a collection of, you know, ragtag people who said what they thought, and they were absolutely... contrary to what we've been used to in the sort of slick Tony Blair years of politics. And so people found them entertaining.
That's right.
And then people started to find them compelling, some people.
Yeah.
And that's what happened with Trump.
Exactly that. It was no surprise, was it, that the first person that Donald Trump welcomed up to Trump Towers after he became president-elect of the United States was UKIP's Nigel Farage. And you can see them, can't you? You can sense them. You can imagine them very easily getting on like some kind of a house on fire.
Yeah, because it's all jolly boys together.
Yeah. Kath, would you be kind enough just to remind the good listener of how they can, if they wish, contact the programme with any random thoughts that they have? We are talking about UKIP this evening because it looks as though UKIP might be coming to the end of the road.
OK. Well, give us a ring. 0344 499 1000.
Jonathan's done that in Swansea. Good evening, Jonathan.
Evening, Tommy. Evening, Catherine.
Hiya, Jonathan.
Hi. It's a sad day that UKIP seems to be going to the wall, but it's been a long time coming and the party has really not recovered from Paul Nuttall losing the Stoke by-election a couple of years ago.
I think you think that was the turning point?
Yes. Nuttall was ahead in the opinion polls and then it all blew up. He wasn't able to close the deal when he really should have.
I take issue with you on that. I think there's some minutia you're talking about here, which I think is it's better to pull back and kind of look at the big picture. And the big picture with UKIP, of course, is Nigel Farage. And Nigel Farage distancing himself from the party, which he's done for the second or third time over the last 18 months or so, is having the same effect on the party that a change of management at Manchester United, where they'd had Alex Ferguson with so much success for such a long time, they were always going to struggle when Ferguson decided to go, even though they replaced him with some of the best people around, none of them were Alex Ferguson. And there isn't another Nigel Farage out there.
You make a good point, Tommy. But it didn't have to necessarily be as disastrous as it has turned out. There were people in the party who could have more than filled Nigel's shoes, but the party
who?
Seemed to Suzanne Evans.
Go, give me a break. Really? Are you serious? Are you seriously trying to tell me that there is anybody, anybody out there on the British political scene in any party who can hold a hold a candle in terms of populism and popular performance to Nigel Farage? Really?
Well, you're...
Boris, maybe, for 20 minutes.
I was really
talking Dennis Skinner,
about,
yeah, but he's only been a backbench man.
I was talking more about UKIP rather than Farage. I mean, UKIP's legacy, though, will be that they changed the course of British history forever and for the good. But more than that, their impact went beyond Britain. They certainly contributed in part to the inevitable collapse of the European Union, and they even had a peripheral effect on the Trump phenomena in America. So the legacy will live on, the brand will live on, the name will live on. It is sad.
Do you know what they were going to be called before they decided to call themselves UKIP?
No, I have no idea.
They were going to be BIP. Yeah. Not a lot of people know this.
The British Independence Party?
But they decided, and they decided quite rightly, that that was too close to another party that occupied not at all the same ground as BIP would have occupied, but because BIP and BNP sounded so close, they were worried about crossover.
Yeah, you can imagine the posters would have been tagged with.
It's interesting that you bring up the BNP, because this is one of the good things about UKIP. A lot of people who were disillusioned with mainstream politics about 10 years ago were voting for the BNP, particularly in the European elections. But after that farcical question time where Nick Griffin really made a pillock of himself, most people abandoned the BNP, thank God, and there was a credible, fairly sensible alternative already there waiting for these disillusioned voters, led by someone where whether you disagree with him or agree with him or whatever you think about his character, he was a personality, he had a vision, and he saw that vision through close to fruition in Nigel Farage.
Nigel Farage. Nigel, what's his full name? Nigel Paul Farage. I've been doing some digging into UKIP and into Nigel Paul Farage. I didn't know that his dad had a really extraordinary moniker. Do you know what his dad was called?
No.
His dad was called Guy Justus Oscar Farage, which is quite a name to carry around, isn't it? And according to Radio 4, so it's not necessarily true, poor old Nigel's dad was a stockbroker and an alcoholic who left the family when Nigel was just 5. And all these little bits and pieces that you don't necessarily know about somebody, but once you do, with retrospect, it rather contributes and broadens and thickens your understanding of the person. Jonathan, thank you very much indeed for your call. Look forward to talking to you again sometime soon. It's 10:15 and it's Tommy in for Ian Lee. Kath is here and Sam later. We've just noticed that we might be about to say goodbye to UKIP. And so we're kicking them around for the first part of the programme. We'll also be talking about Salisbury, because that's not going away. And we're also going to be talking about pay disparity, gender disparity and pay. The BBC are letting it be known that an awful lot of their employees are paid a lot more if they're male, and so are Channel 4. I'm just wondering whether I can ask Kath whether it happens at Talk Radio. I'll discuss it with her during the joys of a commercial break rather than have her throwing teacups at me in the studio yet again. That telephone number again, Kath, is...
0344 499 1000.
And what about texts and things?
You can.
There it is, you can. And indeed Dave has. Well, he's SMS'd. He said, we voted out. Why are the government dithering? I voted for the referendum party. I voted UKIP. I voted Brexit. MPs think they know best. They're just employees. Do what we instructed you to do, says Dave in Hove. I don't agree with that. That's not actually how our political system works. Dave's wrong there.
We pay them to make decisions for us.
Yes, exactly. Exactly, which is why I don't vote.
Oh, right, because it's their job.
No, I don't want to vote. I don't want to encourage anybody else to act on my behalf. If I wanted to leave Europe, I would go about leaving Europe myself. I don't want to elect somebody to do that for me, or elect somebody and find out later whether they think that's a good thing or a bad thing. Mm. I think I know enough not to need somebody to act on my behalf. It's an arrogance. It's a conceit, isn't it?
It's a point of view.
It's just swagger, pure swagger. But that's why I don't vote. On the one occasion that I did vote, I was quite disconcerted to discover that you don't even need to turn up with your paperwork. You can just go up to the desk and say, "Hello, T. Boyd, 27 Acacia Avenue." And they'll go, "Oh, yes, here's a slip." And in you go and vote. They don't know who you are. You don't have to bring your driving licence or anything.
I haven't been to a polling station for years, and I do vote every time.
Postally?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Days in advance.
Okay, why?
Convenience.
And you put it in the post.
And that's that.
It's like an ordinary letter, and that's that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, do you have to apply for a postal vote?
You do, in the first instance, but then it just keeps coming.
Okay. Well, rattle through a few calls. A very quick word with Alan Caddick, who's in Birmingham, in the West Midlands, of course. Good evening, Alan. You say what?
Oh, it's a bad day in the entertainment world, because we lost Katie Boyle.
Yes, I said to Kath when I arrived this evening, I said, now there's only one Katie Boyle.
The original Katie Boyle, because she was the Queen of Eurovision.
Well, she hosted the Eurovision Song Contest twice, yes.
A lot of those places are republics.
It was four times she hosted Eurovision.
Mm. Yes, Kath has just made a very important point. You're royalising Europe. There's very few active monarchs in Europe. So she couldn't really be the queen.
No, but if Terry Wogan was the king of commentary for Eurovision, Katie Boyle was the queen of presenting.
Yeah, I understood. I know what you're driving at. Although, just going back to the crowned heads of Europe, before we came on the air, I don't know how it came into the conversation, Kath told me a really good bit of gossip about the king of Spain. Can you repeat it?
Probably, yeah.
Excellent.
Well, when I lived in Spain, it was quite a well-known thing amongst people, quite a well-known piece of juicy gossip, that the King of Spain had his fair share of lovers dotted around Spain, and he would often, if he was in a certain town where he had someone handy nearby, he would often go off on his motorbike, give the bodyguards the slip and go off and have a night of fun and frolics.
It's good to be the king.
Exactly.
I think that was Mel Brooks. I can't remember which film. But it's good.
I thought that was Jerry the King Lawler.
Maybe. What, it's good to be the king?
Yeah.
And speaking of King of Spain, it gives me an opportunity to tell my Ashley Giles cricket story.
Go on.
Ashley Giles is a spinner, Kath. Does that mean anything to you?
I'm a cricket widow, so you've just said cricket and I go to my happy place.
Sam, do you know anything about cricket? Alan, do you know anything about cricket?
No, I always listen to Test Match Special.
Anyway, so Ashley Giles becomes England's number one off spinner, and he's lauded. He's lauded, and they call him the King of Spin, the King of Spin. And so his marketing people decide that what they'll do is they'll buy 10,000 Ashley Giles King of Spin mugs to sell at a profit to fans.
Yeah.
So they send away for them and then they open them and they discover that it doesn't say Ashley Giles King of Spin.
Mm.
They got back to the company that did this personalising of mugs and said, "We didn't ask for this." And they said, "No, we saw what you wrote, but we couldn't believe that that's what you meant. We assumed it was a typographical error, and you meant Ashley Giles, King of Spain."
Oh, my God.
So they ended up with 10,000 mugs that said Ashley Giles, King of Spain. But the thing was, they sold like hotcakes.
I wonder how much they're worth on eBay.
Because you had a story attached to them.
I've got a wonderful mug.
Yeah.
I've got a Hillary Clinton, President of the USA mug.
That would be worth a fortune.
Yeah, they'd reduced it by a dollar the day after the... Brilliant. I've got the two labels still stuck on it.
Alan, thank you for your call. Talk to you again sometime. Talking UKIP, talking pay disparity, particularly Navratilova versus McEnroe, and then, of course, Salisbury. There are updates on the whole Salisbury spy poisoning story, which we'll get to as the evening unfolds. I'm Tommy, in for Ian Lee.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Tommy Boyd. Tommy Boyd on Talk Radio.
One of the neatest ironies for a long, long time is that the UKIP MEP, who has been ordered to pay a huge six-figure sum to three Labour MPs who she slandered, Jane Collins, decided to repeal, against the judgment of a British court, to the European court.
Wow.
I mean... yeah, it's one of those, isn't it, really? And the European court actually said, we don't have any jurisdiction over this. What she tried to argue was that she was allowed to make fair and just and reasonable comments against political opponents under cover of the support of the European Parliament.
Some sort of privilege.
That's the word I was hunting for. Yeah, a bit like you can say things in the House of Commons that you couldn't say outside the House of Commons. Mm. And they said, no, not so.
Not in public, mate.
No. It's a huge irony, that, isn't it, though?
I mean...
UKIP started in 1991 and they weren't even called BIP then. They were called, bit of a mouthful, the Anti-Federalist League. Now, I think you can go a long way with anti as the first word of any movement, because we like being anti more than we like being pro, don't we?
Mm.
Isn't there something much better about dissidence?
Yeah, if you're being
than harmony.
Being cross.
Yes. I feel as though I exist if I'm anti something. Anti blood sports, for example, that's an obvious one. You know. I don't know what antimatter is, but it's not the same
sort of thing.
It
sounds like an awful sort of thing.
It sounds really like getting on the same side of, doesn't it? You want to be on side with antimatter.
Down with this sort of thing.
There is talk of you can create antimatter. Apparently a very small amount of it has been created in a laboratory somewhere. A tiny amount of it. And they figure that if you can create enough of it, you're going to have something that is going to make the hydrogen bombs look like firecrackers.
Is that what they're trying to do with that Hadron Collider?
We don't know what they're trying to do with the Hadron Collider.
Mm.
Do we?
Apart from create some sort of black hole.
Stephen Hawking did.
Yeah.
But we can't ask him anymore.
And even if we had asked him, we would nod and smile and not get it, would we?
Did you read A Brief History of Time?
Did I, Eck?
Did you buy it?
No.
I bought it.
Mm. And?
Well, it was exactly the same as Wittgenstein's Tractatus. I sat down with a cup of coffee and I thought, right, here we go. Brief History of Time. Lovely. And about a page and a half in, all I knew was that I am as stupid as I had long suspected, at least when it comes to something like this.
Do you find you have a similar kind of mental screensaver that goes up when you watch Brian Cox's programmes?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They look great. And then I realise that my brain has gone into pause.
Yeah. And you're not really there. But you're looking at the screen, but you're not following it particularly. No,
completely. But it's beautiful.
No. But like I said, it's better being an anti than a pro.
Mm.
And so there was hope that when it began, UKIP, as the Anti-Federalist League, dreamed up by a man called Alan Sked. And I'm only guessing here, but I don't think anybody's heard of him.
No.
Alan Sked. He was a professor at the LSE and an occasional Liberal candidate for Parliament. And his thing was just that he was anti-Maastricht. He was anti-federal Europe. That's all it was. Nothing about immigration or any of the other things, individualism and, you know, the rights of those who don't have a voice. Nothing to do with any of that, just against a federal Europe. And so he started that party up. And in actual fact, my reading between the lines of him is that he ended up in a very short space of time, once people started to come on board, he ended up being the Anti-Federalist League himself. A bit like the woman who invented Mother's Day. 20 years later, she said, I don't want anything to do with this, ban it. It's not what I had in mind at all. And Alan Sked was pretty much the same, according to what my understanding. The Anti-Federalist League was quickly taken over by certain individuals, one of whom was, quite quickly, Nigel Paul Farage. That was 1991 it started up. It changed its name to UKIP in 1993. The poor old Alan Sked wasn't around so much then, so there were two or three individuals who were sort of in charge of it, and one of them was Nigel Paul Farage. And yeah, it was their decision not to call it the British Independence Party because that sounded too much like the BNP. But they hit the ground running. They were only a few months old when they got 1% of the vote in the European Parliament elections, which meant that from nowhere they'd become the fifth largest political party in Britain. And, you know, from nowhere to that in 9 months, you know, we ought to have seen what was coming, didn't we? Let's take a call. We'll go to Glyn, who's on the line from Stockport. Good evening, Glyn.
How are you, Sammy? You all right?
I'm undeservedly well, thank you for asking. You?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good.
The point I'd like to make is whatever party the establishment doesn't like, you take through the courts and bankrupt them, no matter what. Be it left and be it right.
What a load of rubbish.
You told me about conspiracy theory. You told me about conspiracy theory once.
Well, obviously it didn't teach you well enough, because that's rubbish. It's a rubbish conspiracy theory.
Not.
Of course it is.
You take them to court on a point of view and make sure that the legal costs are enough to bankrupt the party.
When did it happen before then?
It happened with BNP, actually.
Well, go on. I missed that. I was obviously on holiday that week.
Well, Nick Griffin made a faux pas, didn't he? And he took Nick Griffin personally to court. And the BNP... Don't get me wrong, Tommy. I hate the BNP. I'm not whatever them. What I'm saying is the establishments get their own way all the time.
Now, look, what this MEP said about the three Labour MPs was quite simply disgusting and totally unacceptable, completely without foundation. So what are you going to do?
Well, I'll give you a counter-argument. Labour discriminate against me because they charge me more to get into their meetings because I'm a white male. So why aren't they taken to court for discrimination?
What are you talking about?
Well, you've not heard.
But no, obviously I haven't heard, so tell me.
So if I'm not an LGBT, I will get charged more to go to Labour meetings. Than an LGBT, which I don't have a problem with. So why should I be charged more than them?
Well, I can only assume that you're talking about what most organisations do, which is have a sliding scale of charges for attendance to rock concerts.
Automatically assumed.
I have no idea about the specifics of which you're talking, but the broad principle that some people should say pay more and would be happy to pay more in accordance with their circumstances, okay, for whatever it is whichever service they require, is perfectly legitimate, and I think it's a wonderful idea. That's why, for example, now I've got my own senior rail card. Are you going to deny me that? No.
Well, no.
And quite right, too. Who are you to deny me to use my senior rail card just because I'm a senior? You're going to say to me that you're being discriminated against by the Department of Transport because you don't have a senior rail card. You see what I'm saying here? Because you're talking... Because we're talking about variegated charges.
No, I'm talking about...
You're talking about variegated charges. And you don't understand that's what they are.
I'm talking about the establishment, the courts, and the established parties, the Tories, Labour Party, and the insignificant Liberals these days, destroying minority parties of whatever persuasion. And they're doing it through the courts.
Yeah, that's because...
parties.
Yeah, what you don't understand, Glyn...
Right, well, I'll say something.
No, you can listen to me when I say you don't understand something. You have put a sock in it and listen. Right, what you don't understand is that the procedure that has brought the MEP Jane Collins to her financial knees and the UKIP party potentially to its financial knees, right?
Yes.
Is a just, righteous, fully publicised, fully explored legal procedure to which you, Glyn, cannot point out one discrepancy. You can't point up any twist or turn of the legal procedure that could bring down UKIP that is wrong.
Well, what would have happened if it had happened in our house?
Can you point out?
Because the establishment...
No, the question is very clear. Would you like me to repeat it?
Yes.
Why? Weren't you listening the first time?
Yes, I was listening the first time.
Did you not understand it?
No, because the excuse is they've got them. They can get them to court.
That's not the question.
No.
You can have one last go at the question, and then I'll let you carry on driving safely, I hope.
Tommy, I'm not driving. My good lady's driving.
Just as well. Can you point up any aspect of the legal process that to which you refer that you consider to be anything other than proper?
No.
Okay, thanks. Nice talking to you. Good night. Got there in the end, didn't I?
I had a look at the Labour Party's website. The only discount I could see was for members of the armed forces.
Yeah. Often people have what's called false memory. I'm not accusing Glyn of having a false memory. But sometimes when the world seems wrong to us, we can come up with wrongs that aren't actually there. So I think he's basically, you know, with the best will in the world, he's probably got the wrong end of the stick somewhere along the line.
Yeah, nothing about LGBT.
No.
20 to 26, retired, unwaged, part-time worker or affiliated trade union members, but also available for those 14 to 19 years old, students, current or former members of the British Armed Forces.
You see, this is why we like to have you producing. Isn't it, really?
Do we?
Can do that. No, because you can do that.
But maybe I'm wrong.
No, you're never wrong. Was it my dad always used to say, I'm not always right, but I'm never wrong. I like that.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Isn't that beautiful? He didn't say many beautiful things. That was one of them. I think the only other profound thing my dad ever said to me, God bless him, he said, he was a Geordie.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you prefer blondes or brunettes, man? I was about 14. And I went, I don't know, Dad. And he said to me, I'd give you a little tip, he said. Broadly speaking, everybody's listening here, because it's quite good, this. He went, broadly speaking, brunettes are dirtier. I said, what?
What? How old were you?
14. He said, brunettes are dirtier. Now, because I was 14, I'd never been kissed.
Yeah.
I assumed that this was something to do with hygiene.
Yeah, stinky.
Yeah. And that blondes...
Well, could be to do with hygiene.
...spent longer in the bathroom, had more showers, you know, dried between their toes, all that sort of thing. I didn't realise that he was referring to something...
Proclivities.
I don't know what that means, so I'll just nod and link to a commercial break. Back in a second.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Tommy Boyd. Tommy Boyd on Talk Radio.
UKIP may or may not cease to be fairly soon, so we're not playing the last post, but we're looking back at them and just chewing the fat about them. UKIP, really, you can't get past looking at and celebrating, even if you don't like him, Nigel Farage, because he's an extraordinary character who has lifted our lives and is certainly an example to anybody who wants to try and achieve something enormous, because he set out to achieve the almost impossible and did. So we're kicking them around, but we're also talking about Ken Dodd. Why is that?
Ken Dodd. How did we come up with Ken Dodd?
Anywhere we are.
Yeah.
Because they published a lot of his jokes, didn't they? Some of the good ones. What did he say about alternative comedy? That's when you laugh at every other joke. It's quite a good one. But in my newspaper, they were trying to work out whether or not the story about him and a member of parliament is true. And the story is that a man came down to visit a member of parliament in the House of Commons and was shown into his office. And in order to break the ice, he noticed... Do you know this?
No, go on.
He saw a photograph of Ken Dodd on the man's desk. And so he said to him, to break the ice, he said, "Oh, I'm an enormous fan too." And the MEP said, "Of whom?" He said, "Well, Ken Dodd." And the MP said, "Well, what makes you think I'm a fan of Ken Dodd?" He said, "Well, you've got a picture of him on your desk." And the MP said, "That's my wife."
Oi!
Ah! Ooh!
There's no coming back from that, is there?
No. Now, at the time of it coming out, this newspaper worked really hard to try and find out whether it's true or not and decided that it probably is, but some of the people have been changed just to protect the innocent. But there. We go now to a caller who has described themselves as Avadig, and Avadig is on line 7 and it says that he or she is from the VDP.
Yes, indeed. Good evening, all. Yes, a very disappointed party.
Ah.
You should have known this, of course, Tommy, because we're very disappointed generally with the points of debate that people take, especially those nominating themselves on radio. My main point being is this. What about fish? The fish that surround the British Isles that the Scots keep on complaining about, and indeed they choose to go where they choose. They don't choose denominations, they don't choose regulations, and they certainly don't choose political organisations. And why is it that they should be subject to political debate?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because in the most recent round of agreements that have been reached between David Davis and his counterparts in Europe, it looks as though the one industry that was almost certain to benefit from Brexit from the get-go, which is the British fishing industry, is in fact going to have to maintain the current quotas at least until the end of the transition period, which at the moment is set for something like 18 months from now.
So therefore, following on from what you're saying, they're trying to legislate underwater species that choose to be where they choose to be, whether it's within our territorial waters.
I've always taken issue with when I go past a pub down on the south coast and they have a chalk A-board outside saying local fish.
They have them in the north coast as well.
And how do I want to say to them, how do you know?
Well, I've been there.
No, I don't mean that. I mean, how do they know that the fish are local? The fish may have been caught off the Shoreham coastline, but they may have been passing through.
They may have even been a trout or indeed a salmon that have actually been born indigenously from our country in territorial waters.
Yes.
And just gone for a day out.
Yes. Yes, what nationality is a cod?
Yes. How can you possibly?
Then I've got an interesting quiz question for you.
Quiz on.
I will, and I'll ask Kath as well, and Sam, and the good listener. But I will give the answer. I won't keep you hanging on.
You're going to quit.
What is the largest British animal?
There's a question. Boris Johnson's a bit fat, isn't he?
What is the largest British animal?
Go on, do tell.
Come to think of it, if you're not as clever...
A magpie.
If you're not as clever as me, it's quite possible that the largest British animal is the heaviest British person.
Ding dong.
Bigger than an Aberdeen Angus.
Well, that's not a fish, is it?
We didn't say fish, we said animal.
Didn't say fish, please pay attention.
You did indeed say animal, yes. Go on, do pray tell.
The largest British animal... Cat, get your fingers off those keyboards.
I'm not.
Cat, you're not that big, I'm sure.
The largest British animal, according to experts, and we like experts...
We love them.
Are you ready for this?
Is
the basking shark.
Indeed.
Which is occasionally indigenous to British waters.
What is it? Do they legislate them?
I'm working on this joke, and Avadig, you obviously haven't got much of a sense of humour, but you might be able to advise me on my joke, right?
I'm advising.
Are you ready?
Go on, try it again.
What goes...
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Have you seen the old man? Did he do the streets of London? No, wait. Have you seen the old man in the streets of London? Are you ready?
What, for the answer?
Yeah.
I haven't replied yet. Well, no, I'll skip the reply.
Can you guess?
I'll wait. not on your level, Tommy.
Right.
Of course.
Okay. What do you call? So I've written this. I don't think I can send it off. I often send jokes to Tim Vine.
Well, that's appropriate.
Here we go again. So, what do you call this? Have you seen the old man in the streets of London?
Not yet. No.
You ready?
But I'm about to. I'm visualising
a busking shark. A busking shark.
Yeah.
A busking shark.
Crikey. Does he work in the city?
I haven't really got it quite right, but there's something there, isn't there?
You haven't, have you?
There is something there.
Yeah, exactly. Well, anyway, I've got an argument about people that wear hats, especially politicians. They don't wear enough.
Did you see what the Conservative Transport Minister had to say about...
Did I see what he had to say? Did I hear what he had to say?
Well, she, for a start, but anyway.
Sexist.
Well, you know, I'm not being hattist.
She said that she damned the Labour Party for being led by somebody who wears hats.
Well, they should have had Thatcher as a leader, and then they wouldn't have argued. She wore a hat every now and again.
Not very often.
Well, you know, birth, death and marriages, and she attended a few.
She did, but she spent so much time on her hair, getting it just right, and so much on hairspray that she didn't.
Not surprised. Did you see her husband?
She didn't want hat hair.
Not hat hair.
Anyway, Avadig, thank you so much for your call. It's been a genuine delight, part of the time anyway. So thank you for that. Talk to you again sometime. What a nice person. Nearly. What's our number again?
0344 499 1000.
There's a lot of people turning up on the show this evening on the phones with an agenda.
Yeah.
Which is good.
Well, but be prepared to have your monologue disrupted.
Because this is a news and current affairs show, period. Occasionally we drift into the human condition, but broadly speaking, we run with the news agenda of the day. Which is why Gary's called from Wakefield. Gary.
Hello.
Hello.
Are you all right?
Just about.
Yeah. I spoke to James earlier. I tried to be empathy with him. Try to be real. He didn't get the gist of what I was trying to say.
I wonder why.
Because I get frightened what I'm going to say.
Yeah.
I'm real. All right, Kath.
Hiya, Gary.
Gary. I speak to Lane. Mm.
Lane, a.k.a. Huey of the Spheres, a.k.a. Cleo, has tweet, Tommy Boyd, I think the theme tune to the Benny Hill
Come
show... No, I haven't.
All right.
He cut me off. I'm just keeping the sort of mosaic.
I like it real, me. I'm with a friend who's had cancer twice.
No. I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah.
And I hope you don't get it three times.
And she's still in there, all over to bits.
What can you do? Just keep battling away.
There for her.
Yeah, I suppose so. I think the theme tune to the Benny Hill show is more appropriate than the last post.
Oh, my God. The theme tune to the Benny Hill show.
Yeah. Something like that. Gary, thank you for your call. All of human life. Because the other joke I've got, funnily enough, funny that Lane should write and say that the Benny Hill theme will be better than the last post. Because the joke that I've got is quite good. It features a man nudging his wife in the middle of the night and saying, what was that? And she says, what? And he goes, listen. And from downstairs he hears... And he says, you phone the police, I'm going downstairs with a poker. I think we've got buglers.
Oh, Tommy.
That's all right, isn't it?
Well,
it fell into the conversation, you see, is the thing. So we were picking our way through the more interesting moments in the history of UKIP, since it could be that in the not-too-distant future we won't have them to kick around anymore, as Richard Nixon said when he left the White House. They won't have Richard Nixon to kick around anymore. And not a lot of people know that UKIP nearly died a death before they got going, because James Goldsmith set up a thing called the Referendum Party. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
And they were much bigger than UKIP. Much bigger than UKIP, because they were better funded, because Goldsmith was loaded. But unfortunately for him and many, he passed away, James Goldsmith, leading a vacuum. And, of course, nature abhors a vacuum. Have you heard that phrase?
Yes, I have.
How can it abhor a vacuum? Nature moves in to replace a vacuum with anything that's available, such as air.
Yes.
But that doesn't mean to say that it has the emotion of aberration.
Well, I guess we're making nature with a capital N.
Yes. What's that word where you give human characteristics to something that's not human?
Is it? Well, anthropomorphizing. Animals, though,
yes.
Isn't it?
I don't know whether...
No, it's not just animals, is it? It's objects too.
Yes. So if you give the cold wind some kind of human characteristic by, you know, cracking its cheeks, for example, as Shakespeare has it, you're anthropomorphising the elements.
Mm.
So anyway, UKIP turned itself around after James Goldsmith passed away, leaving this vacuum, which nature and the UKIP abhorred. And in 1999, when the European Parliament held elections and for the first time ever used proportional representation, that was the big moment in UKIP's history. Because with 6.5% of the votes, they ended up with three seats. And those three seats were a man called Michael Holmes for South West England, a man called Geoffrey Titford as UKIP's MEP for the East of England. And he was formerly, before he was an MEP, he was the president of the National Federation of Funeral Directors. So he was a big undertaker. And one other man who became the MEP for the southeast of England, and that was, once again, a Mr. Nigel Paul Farage. Ah, I seem to have made a mistake with the timing of this programme. Shall I just talk over the news, Sam? So just link to the news and then shut up. I apologise there. I got carried away. I was so excited about UKIP.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Tommy Boyd.
Tommy Boyd on Talk Radio.
We're saying goodbye, perhaps, to UKIP over the next few weeks if it turns out that they're not able to pay the legal bills that they're being charged by due process, then they may have to be declared bankrupt. And if they are declared bankrupt, it's unlikely they're going to be able to field candidates at, for example, the forthcoming local elections. And will we miss them? I think we will. Whatever we think about their politics, they have definitely been a colourful influence on the British scene for whatever it is, 20 years. 1991 they started, so what's that? 25 years they've been with us. And I suppose the point is you have to accept that against all the odds, they did what they said they were setting out to do. They did what it said on the tin. They got us out of Europe. So we're discussing that. And we're also going to be looking at gender pay disparity. Because it, you know, in an ideal world, in 50 years' time, everybody will be paid the same, no matter what their gender. It's a bit of a throwback, really, that there are certain jobs that women can't do. OK, you can certainly cite the importance of physical strength in certain lines of work. But women, in my house, my wife is just as strong as me. When we had to shift a washing machine the last time, and that is a demand, moving a washing machine around, my wife was able to literally hold her end up just as well as me, you know. And not long ago, I had to call the fire brigade because I was on a roundabout and a woman stalled. She had a baby in the car and she stalled right in the middle of the roundabout. And, of course, the cars coming round the roundabout couldn't see this stalled car, so they were having to swerve round her one side or the other. And it was obviously a very dangerous situation. So I ran across to her and tried to push the car to safety, but I wasn't strong enough. So it happened that the roundabout was the home of our local fire brigade. So I ran round the corner and I knocked on the fire brigade door and they said yes. And I said, 999, there's a car stalled on the roundabout with a baby in it. And if we're not careful, pretty soon there's going to be a prang. So I was wondering whether we could shift it. So they said, OK, you go and attend to the car and we'll be round. So I ran round to the car and 10 seconds later, out of the fire station was, you know, whatever noise they make. And they turned up. And the chief firefighter, he said to me, what seems to be the problem, sir? And I said, well, look, it's this. I said, I need some of your men to push the car off the roundabout. Otherwise, the woman and her child are in great danger. And he made a point of, before he actually solved the situation, the senior firefighter looked at me and he just went, men and women these days, sir, which I thought was good. You know, there's an accident going on or a potential accident about to happen, but he still felt the need to point out that firefighters are now men and women before. And it was 9 men and 1 woman, but there was a woman. And we're talking about gender and all the complexities of gender equality, mm-hmm. Kath.
It's got more complicated recently, hasn't it?
It's going to get more complicated before it gets less complicated.
Yes.
But in the end, it'll be very uncomplicated. There won't be any.
Yeah, I think that's probably the way it's going. Rather than he, she, everyone will be they.
Yes, I do. I have to correct my wife about that. Because if a wasp flies into the house, she always says, you know, shall we kill him or try and waft him out?
I bet a bee is a her.
No, my wife gives everything the he.
Oh, it's him, is it?
Yeah, and I have to keep correcting her. Now she's getting fed up with it. But I do, because I'm trying to be a modern man. I want to be accepted by women as being, you know, one of those nice men who gets it. And most of the time I do. Sometimes it's an act. When we come round to the reason why gender pay disparity is in the news today, it's because Martina Navratilova is complaining that she's paid considerably less than John McEnroe for doing what she considers to be the same job. What's your position on that?
Which job are we referring to? Playing or
commentating? Co-commentating, which is where you're the expert. So you have a commentator who does the, and here goes Charlie Passerell to serve. And then in between points, the co-commentator says things like, I think he ought to concentrate more on his backhand because, you know.
Sure.
So that's the job.
Well, that's down to her agent to negotiate, surely.
That's a good point. I don't know if she uses an agent. Some organisations don't allow you to talk to, don't allow you to have agents.
I can't imagine you deal directly with McEnroe.
He's an interesting character. I bumped into him a few times at tennis tournaments because I used to work at a tennis tournament called the Stella, it was then, and used to bump into McEnroe occasionally. He's a character. He's like that all the time. Yeah. He's like he is, like we know him, you cannot be serious. He's like that all the time.
I don't think you could keep that up for years and years, could you?
If it wasn't the case.
Also, he couldn't behave for however long a tennis match went on, so why would he do it in real life?
But you see, supposing you've got two teachers in a school, right? One's 45 and he's a male. Mm-hmm. One's 25 and she's a female. There's going to be a pay disparity there because of...
It's about, time on the clock.
Yes. Experience and responsibility.
Sure.
Because probably if you are a 45-year-old teacher, you might be head of a department, and so that's going to necessarily accrue some additional pay.
Qualifications. He'll have been sent on more courses, you'd imagine.
Okay. So what we're talking about is two 25-year-old people taking up their first or second jobs in a primary school. One's male, one's female.
Right.
Is there a pay gap there?
There shouldn't be, should there?
Is there, though?
There was with my first job.
Which was in?
In radio.
What happened?
Broadcast journalist.
Go on.
I started my job, and this was not in the BBC. This was in a commercial thing. So the argument... I'll get to the argument afterwards. But so I started my first job, and fresh out of college, and with a degree, then a postgraduate diploma in broadcast journalism. Started this job, took the money that I was offered, because I had no bargaining chips. Even with your first job, you take what you're given, don't you? £11,000. That was my wage. I was there for a month, and was joined by another member of staff, same job as I had. Same qualifications, same lack of experience. We were quite pally and we were both new to the area. And he said to me, how much do you come away with at the end of a month? Mm-hmm. Because I'm not sure, it was our first proper job. So, we got sort of pensions taken out of things and tax and stuff. How much do you come away with? So I told him, he said, what, out of £12,000? And that's how I found out he was being given an extra £1,000, presumably extra £5,000 for each gonad.
500, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. For each gonad. Your maths went awry there because you're
thinking
distracted
about gonads.
By gonads, yeah.
Yeah, they are quite distracting.
I often hear that with newsreaders when they've got a very difficult new African name to pronounce and they really can see it coming.
Yeah.
And they've practiced it in the corridor. They've walked up and down with their news bulletin and they've gone, in coma or whatever, and then they get that right.
Yeah, and then
they get the next word, which is cheese, wrong.
Exactly.
Because they're focusing. Yeah. So that's on the side there. Tell you what, the pay disparity thing is really interesting, and I want to find out what you said was the reason behind it.
Right.
Let's take a call because we need to mix it up.
Go on.
And if people are calling, then we should pay more pay deference to their contribution to the program. Frank, it is who's next. From St Albans, who wants a word about Grenfell. Is that right, Frank?
Hello, Tommy. Good evening.
Good evening.
Great show.
Just a second. Are you on speakerphone, Frank?
No.
How come you sound so far away?
Oh, sorry, I'm speaking in the kitchen.
Hang on. Just a second. Could you put your mouth a bit closer to your phone?
Okay, I am.
That's much better, Frank.
Hello, mate.
Well, it's slightly better.
Yeah. Tommy, quick thing. I read an article today in the paper. I won't tell what paper it was. 8 months it's been since the Grenfell Tower. No questions asked. People that lost, their loved ones. Do you know what? I'm a Liverpool fan. In 1989, 96 Liverpool fans lost their lives in the Hillsborough disaster. Families fought tooth and nail to get justice. How long do these people have to wait to get answers? Three simple questions. Who done the cladding outside the building that was flammable? Who was the one that actually authorised this work to be carried out? These people should be held in contempt of the actual criminal things that they've done. I know there's an investigation going on. My God, Tommy. Why can't these people get answers? 8 months. Mm. We investigate everything when there's a criminal activity that goes on, and the police do a wonderful job, and they are stretched, to the maximum. They can't do everything because they're understaffed, they're underfunded, and it's, but But Tommy, we're living in the UK, mate, and we seem to be going. It seems to be getting worse, mate. Everything that happens, investigation and this and the other. Who's accountable? These people want answers, mate. Do you know what I mean? If it happened to be somebody from your family or my family or anybody that works for your radio station that lost their loved ones, mate, I'm sure you want these questions answered. Why is it taking 8 months? You know, who's responsible? There's only simple questions that they want. Who's responsible? The health and safety of the place, the cladding that was done outside the building, they found that the material was flammable. Who was the one that installed it that they knew that the stuff was flammable and it caught fire and the whole building went up? People lost their lives, mate. Tommy, it's sad. It's very, very sad, mate. And these people are suffering every single second and minute of the day, mate.
Sure.
And it's heartbreaking, mate. It really is. And I actually rang up LBC. I'm going to mention him. And I actually offered I live in London Coney here in Hertfordshire, and I actually offered my place to anybody that needed a place to stay. I offered my spare bedroom for wherever that needed a place to stay, rather than staying in a hotel and all this, that and the other. And obviously I didn't get no reply because obviously they got put in hotels and all that. But my offer still stood. But these people need answers, Tommy. And I think it's been far too long, mate. And these people are going to suffer every single day. Doesn't matter what hotel you live, they just want answers. They want to know who's responsible and who's...
Yeah, let's go. Let's just... OK, we've got your point. Got your point. I'll tell you what would be interesting to do, because I agree with you entirely, and I think everybody listening will agree with you entirely.
Yep.
But one of the interesting aspects of the whole of the Hillsborough saga, for me,
yep,
and also for this tragedy,
yep,
and actually many others.
Give the families answers, mate. That's what it's all about, mate.
Hang on a second.
Yep, go on.
Because that is my point.
Give them the truth.
Yeah.
Give them peace and...
Frank.
Yeah.
Just listen for a second.
Yeah,
I've got a very interesting point to make.
Thank you, Tommy.
Okay. And I'll be interested to hear your answer to the point. And Kath's, actually, and Sam's.
Yep.
And indeed my own, because I don't understand this. When you have a tragedy such as Hillsborough or such as Grenfell...
Yep.
Why it is that establishing that somebody transgressed can play such an important part in the healing process. Because it doesn't bring anybody back.
Yeah.
It doesn't reduce any amount of suffering that took place at the time of the tragedy.
Yep.
And yet it does seem to play an important part, and I'm certainly not condemning this phenomenon. I'm merely inquiring into it as why it is the case. You see, let me tell you a little story. I know somebody whose father was killed by terrorists. And in the course of an argument, I'd forgotten about that. And I was trying to mansplain to this person that whenever a terrorist takes the life of an innocent victim, there's a danger that, and this happened a lot in the Troubles of Northern Ireland, that another terrorist will spring up to seek to get revenge for the action of the initial terrorist atrocity. And this person just said to me, well, I've never wanted anybody to suffer retribution to what happened to my dad.
Yeah, that's a fair point, mate.
So why was she able to move forward without seeking to discover who was culpable?
Because when you lose somebody that you love, mate, and you don't get no answers, mate, that's one thing that you got to wake up every morning.
No, you see, my point, Frank, from what I just said, if you were paying attention, is that that's not the case for everybody.
Yeah, but it is the case for these people that have lost.
So the question then is why? And it's a delicate question, but one I'm asking. Why?
Because they want straight answers, mate.
But why?
They're not getting straight answers.
But why? Why? How does it help them psychologically?
Because it helps them give them peace.
How, though? Can you explain that process? I can
because
see...
Because at the end of the day, mate, when I... You know what I mean? My, even though I was born here, mate, I come from Sicily, where we've been involved with the mafia. When you open up a business, they come into your shop and they, you know, to take money from you and this and the other. And you see people suffering because of the way the mafia's behaved, the way...
There's one thing to want to make sure that...
Yeah, but...
It's, people, no, wait, wait. Wait, Frank. It's one thing to want to make sure that injustice doesn't happen again. Yes, that's important. But from what you've said, that is not one of the factors that is.
But people want justice, mate. I think all of us in England and the UK and the rest of the Great Britain Islands that we're here, we just want justice, mate. And if justice doesn't happen, mate, we're just sweeping everything under the carpet, mate. And we can never, until these people are brought to criminal proceed, criminal to be.
But there's a danger here, Frank. There's a danger here, and it is a real danger that what you're looking for is criminal prosecution, where at this point in time, no one has any evidence that any crime has taken place.
So everything, the cladding that was done on the outside of the building, which was an inflammable material, the health and safety of the building that was carried out, and every building that actually gets insured has to have an inspector that goes around and inspects that building, and they basically pass it through and say, yeah, this building is all right. Mate, there was only one way in and one way out, and we're talking about everything. We're not just talking about a certain specific thing.
But would it
happened.
Make you feel better? You didn't lose anybody in Grenfell.
Well, I felt it for these people, mate, because at the end of the day, mate, I'm a caring
person. Look, will
person.
You stop calling me mate like that? It really annoys me. I'm sorry, but it does. I'm not your mate. Now, please don't say mate at the end of every half sentence.
Okay.
Thank you.
So you don't care then, Tommy?
Now, you see, that is rude.
Well, no, because in the day...
Now, you've just been rude, and I'm going to have to let you go. And before I let you go, I'm going to tell you that I think that it is wrong of you to act with the same level of self-righteous indignation about an awful tragedy, which we all want to see justly resolved, if that's ever in any way possible, and the right amount of compensation, whether it's financial or emotional, is given to those people who are what's left of Grenfell. We all want to see that, but we all need to keep control, Frank.
Okay.
Control.
Yep.
Right? Of our basic humanity. And you have an opportunity to withdraw something that you just said, and I'd like you to take it.
Well, I'll tell you what, Tommy, I apologise for that.
Thank you.
I've just learned something new in my life, and I offer my sincere apologies if I've offended you or if I might have offended other listeners by saying that. So it's something that I learn, and I've just learned a good thing.
Do you know what ruminating is?
Sorry?
Do you know what ruminating is?
No, I don't understand that word. Sorry, sir.
Ruminating is a psychological phenomenon which we're all actually prey to a lot of the time, which is where we keep going over and over things that have happened in the past, right, to the detriment of our own present and future.
OK.
And there comes a time with everything where you have to move on.
OK, I'm with you. Thank you.
But your heart, the size of your heart and the amount that you care, Frank...
Yep.
Is clear. Don't ever lose that.
No, I won't ever lose
that. But let's keep moving forward.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks, Tommy.
I don't know. Is that all right? Is that 8 out of 10?
Certainly a strong 8.
Good, thanks. You start to feel very vulnerable when you're talking about something as enormous as Grenfell. And certainly Frank's heart's in the right place. But he makes a good point, something that I always struggle with how long these investigations and inquiries take. But you do know that when something awful happens, it's probably going to be this time next year before there are any kind of answers available.
If that. Because it doesn't just stop at Grenfell, does it? On my drive into work, I've seen there are about four blocks, which obviously had the same cladding as Grenfell, that have been completely, they're being completely redone.
Removed.
So it's a systematic problem as well. And you understand why that needs to be looked in at, into at the same time. Unfortunately, there isn't one person twiddling their moustache knowing that they did something wicked.
No.
It's a series of really, really awful, awful events.
And for every single person who woke up that morning and heard the news and then turned on their televisions and looked at the pictures, we were given one of the most harrowing possible scenarios in the top floors of that flat, which, because of the nature of the human mind, we couldn't help but imagine what it might have been like at the very worst scenario, worst case scenario, for some of the people who perished in that fire. And that will stay with us, all of us who had to think that thought and picture that picture, for the rest of our lives. Mm-hmm. Far worse, of course, for the relatives. Quick reminder of our telephone number, Kath, and then we'll...
0344 499 1000.
It's Tommy Boyd in for Ian Lee. You're listening to Talk Radio.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Tommy Boyd.
Tommy Boyd on Talk Radio.
Let's go to Serena, who's called on the same subject as Frank, and she calls from Dunstable. Good evening, Serena. You're on Talk Radio.
Good evening. I rang in to voice my opinion. I think it was unfair what Frank was saying previously. Realistically, after Grenfell, when everyone woke up and heard the tragic news, everyone did think about... Everyone felt so bad for, you know, so bad for them, because everyone's got family, everyone's given so many donations, and the public response was phenomenal. I think it's very unfair how people keep portraying Theresa May, because when that happened to Grenfell, Theresa May went and saw the emergency services the morning after, and then she was portrayed as being a really horrible person because she didn't go and see the victims. What possible outcome would that have created? Because people have just lost their families in that disaster, and it's become just a witch hunt for whoever is in charge as PM. So going to see the victims that morning would have been ridiculous, because everyone is just going to want someone to blame.
And yet people, I agree with you, and yet people do seem to reach out for that, and the press encourage people to reach out for that. So, for example, at New Orleans, George Bush didn't show up, and he was pilloried for that.
Yeah.
Trump showed up at a recent climate disaster. I forget what it was, hurricane.
I was thinking of the shooting, where he was pictured in the hospital, and he made the mistake of sticking his thumbs up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Theresa May turned up at Salisbury a few days afterwards, and the picture that was published in most of the newspapers was her having a laugh with some teenagers bumping fists.
And the thing is the difference here, and the only reason, sorry to jump in, but the reason there's a difference is because after Grenfell, everybody wanted someone to blame, saying that the reason that it had happened was because the poor people were living in that block and they wanted to clad it to make it look good. So, because people from the rich end were not liking the look of that building. That is a preposterous idea. The reason that they put the cladding on there was to rejuvenate London for tourism. It's no reason for the rich people looking out on there. And then they're saying, furthermore, sorry, I'm ranting here, and I know I am, but the reason people were living in those blocks was because they were on low income. And unfortunately, in the way that we live, London is a very expensive place to live. If you're on a low income, you can't live in a palace. That's across the whole of the nation. It's nothing to do with just because they were poor people and they're being discriminated because they're on low wages. If you're on a low wage, I live in Oxford. I don't live in a palace. I'm not on a low income, but I'm a middle-class person. I work hard, but I don't have a four-bedroom palace. That's just the way it is. But Jeremy Corbyn, the next day, he didn't go down to the Grenfell survivors in, you know, a pair of jogging bottoms and a T-shirt to look low-key. He went in a bloody suit so the paparazzi could photograph him having... having cuddles with the people. Well, if he really wanted to help, why didn't he go low-key so the paparazzi didn't see him and help with the bloody sifting through all the donations that had been given?
Ah, well, see, hang on, you make a good point, but maybe he did anonymously and nobody found out.
Well, I don't believe that because everything that he does...
But be careful that that's because that's something that you don't want to believe.
It's not something that I don't want to believe. To be fair, if he's being taken photos of cuddling and hugging the people that have just survived it, then I'm sure as hell know that the paparazzi would have filmed him doing that. So I don't believe that myself. But that's that. The only reason that she was getting fist bumps at Salisbury was because everyone was so disgusted with Jeremy Corbyn's stance on his summary of the whole Novichok scandal.
I think you've lost us all there.
Why would you say that?
Because you lost us. Because I don't understand.
Okay, so on the BBC Parliament when Theresa May...
Let me see if I can come back at you with what you've said and see if I've got it right.
Okay, go for it.
Okay. The reason that Theresa May and the teenage children were bumping fists and smiling in Salisbury was because everyone was so disgusted with what Jeremy Corbyn had to say.
OK, fair point. I haven't made much sense there, but with the...
Oh, Theresa thank Mendes, you. You certainly didn't.
Yeah. With the Theresa May incident, she has taken action on that by, getting rid of 23 diplomats, so people can see that she's doing something about it. Whereas because people couldn't see her doing anything with the public...
Yes, I know, but she was attending the scene of an attempted assassination and a scene at which a British police officer has been rendered seriously ill.
Mm.
To be seen smiling and laughing with some teenagers in the square where that happened and pumping fists with them was inappropriate.
I suppose now you've said it, then yeah, I'd say it probably is quite inappropriate.
But why didn't anybody else notice that when they published those photographs, which were in all of the national papers?
I'm not sure. I don't have an answer for you. I genuinely don't have an answer for you. But regarding Grenfell...
Yes?
Good. Regarding Grenfell, I think it has become a bit of a witch hunt, and I think it's not really fair to also say about... People saying about the housing, because in the paper it's saying about there's still no housing for these people... Although Theresa May is Prime Minister, she's not a magician, and she can't find housing in the middle of London for 100 families. If they're not being built and they're not available, then what can be done?
Yes, I would have thought it was possible to find some alternative housing for the people who have been obviously removed from Grenfell as a result of that tragedy. There was talk, wasn't there, of requisitioning, if that's the right word, some of the enormous mansions that lie empty in that particular borough, of which there are plenty.
I don't know, to be honest, I'm not even going to lie, I don't know, I haven't seen that, I haven't heard that, but I rang in because I felt that Theresa May is getting a bit of a beat in here, and it's not exactly like she's put the cladding on herself, do you know?
Okay, is that a sister's thing?
No, it's not.
Do you think she gets criticism that she wouldn't if she was, Terry May?
No, I don't think so. I think that people, just like a football team, a football manager always isn't doing it right. There's always somebody thinks they can do better.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's the case with Theresa May. Everybody thinks who doesn't, appreciate... I don't know, not appreciate, but lots of people think, we could do a better job, like, for instance, Jeremy Corbyn, who wants her job. And then when it comes down to it, there's only so many cards that you've got.
Yeah.
It's not as easy as that. And I think it's unfair for Theresa May to always get this backlash, always be made out to be a really, horrible person. I mean, the Tinchy Strider rap that had about Grenfell...
Stormzy.
You see, I'm not good with music, but Stormzy, thank you, he put in his lyrics saying along the lines of, people of Grenfell, maybe we should burn your house, Theresa May. I mean, come on. That's disgusting. Those lyrics are disgusting. How can you get away with that?
I don't know enough about that particular genre of music to be able to confirm that those are the lyrics or otherwise. If they are, that seems a bit suspect to me, but then that's part and parcel of rap music, isn't it? Serena?
Yes?
I just want to say thanks for your call very much indeed. Drive on, drive safely. I hope you get home soon, if you're heading home.
Yeah, will do. Will do, yeah. Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye. Oh, very nice lady. I accidentally downloaded a rap album. I'm constantly accidentally downloading things. That's going to be my story.
What did you download?
Oh, where is it? It's quite a well-known rap.
Oh, excellent.
Thing, but I don't know anything about rap music.
Is it JZ?
Find it on my phone. Oh, God, I don't know. Have we got one of those coming up? Yeah. Okay, I'll quickly find the album that I've downloaded so that you can laugh at me, okay, for being a musical dinosaur. It's Tommy, I'm in for Ian Lee. Kathy's here. Sam as well. You're tuned to Talk Radio.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Tommy Boyd.
Tommy Boyd on Talk Radio.
This evening so far, we've been talking about the potential bankruptcy and therefore the demise of UKIP. We're talking about gender pay disparity, particularly John McEnroe versus Martina Navratilova. We're talking about Salisbury because that remains in the news and will probably for the rest of time. Been talking about Grenfell as a result of callers calling in with thoughts and views. And we found ourselves just before that last commercial break. It's Tommy Boyd, by the way, in for Ian Lee. Kathy's here and Sam also. We found ourselves talking about the fact that I accidentally downloaded a rap album. How did we get onto rap?
Stormzy,
thank you. A caller criticised Stormzy for...
Yeah, Serena.
Serena. And the album that I downloaded is called Damn by Kendrick Lamar.
Oh, Kendrick Lamar, very popular.
Oh, look at that. Oh, Kendrick Lamar. Oh, yeah.
I couldn't sing you one of his tunes.
No, nor can he.
You're not impressed?
No, it's good, actually. It's just that I've got one of those robot music systems at home. I won't say which one. There's basically two of them. And it's brilliant because I've signed up so that you can get any music. And so you can literally go, you know, play me White Christmas by Bing Crosby. Bang, there it is. Mm. Unbelievable. You can get any song that's ever been recorded, you can get it in a second.
Isn't it wonderful?
It is fantastic, except sometimes in the upstairs one, which is not linked to that system, I have to just play my own music. So I just go sometimes, computer, play my music. So it goes, playing your music. And sometimes I'll get Lamar. And I'm not in the mood for it.
No.
Because it's pretty
not in the
potent.
Not in the rap mood.
No, no. So I have to be very boring and say, computer, skip, Kendrick, please.
What do you like in a mellow mood?
What do I like?
Mm-hmm.
That's a good question, and it's so shameful I'm not going to say.
Oh, go on.
No.
Is it Boney M?
I've got some worse stuff than Boney M on my phone, if that's
what
you
want. We all have.
Yeah. Quick look at my music, give you some examples.
I thought you might be a jazz man.
Oh, thanks. Worse.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no, I've got my range is pretty eclectic, I think. Lots of film music, Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon is an unbelievable piece of music that didn't make it anything other than as a film theme.
Gene Pitney, isn't it?
Is it?
Is it?
Did not know that.
Is it?
Don't know. I've got some blues, I've got some dance, D&J. I've got some Christmas carols, which always make me cry. No, this is actually quite a decent music collection that I've got at the moment on my phone. Therefore, there's no entertainment mileage in it, so I'll leave it out. Let's have a word with, where should we go next? Seth is on line four, and Seth from Bogdell wants to talk about pay equality. Hello, Seth.
Hey up, Tommy, nice to talk to you again. Do you remember me? You used to call in from Doctor Who night.
No, I still don't. No, still don't.
Anyway, speaking of Doctor Who, I'm just sick to the back teeth of this bloody equality thing. I mean, we had an argument going years back about what was better, Star Trek or Doctor Who, and you said Doctor Who was. But you don't have people in Star Trek that are women pretending to be fellas. And you've got that now in Doctor Who. It's disgusting.
I'm not entirely with you. I'm not sure you are.
He's just regenerated, hasn't he, into a bloody woman.
Yeah, it's about time too, frankly.
No. I mean, you're hired to say that politically correct rubbish.
No,
I mean,
I'm not. No, I'm not. I'm not at all. I'm a red-blooded, testosterone-fueled male who prefers, dare I say it, looking at attractive actresses to looking at attractive actors.
No. So what you're saying, Tommy, is that you used to watch it and you would love to shake his hand, but now you want to have sex with her.
With Doctor Who?
Yeah.
I'm not going to go that far. First of all, because it's inappropriate, even at this time of night, even in 2018.
No, I'm not going to go that far.
But what I'm going to say is what I do, you see, and this is lawful, and this is me being honest, is...
Go on.
Right, because I happen to be heterosexual, it's not a credential. I'm not showing off. You know, because I happen to be heterosexual, ever since I got interested in romance.
Right.
Which I suppose was probably in my early to mid-teens, which is pretty much about par for the course.
Agreed.
I've always been tempted to fall in love. And that's what I'm talking about, falling in love. I used to fall in love with girls on the bus on the way to school who I'd never speak to and English teachers, you know, and stuff like that. And so I'm still tempted to think to myself, if I were to see somebody on television, and let's say it's the new Doctor Who, to say to myself, my wife wouldn't mind me telling you this, because she knows that this is how my heart works, to say to myself, I wonder if the situation had been different and we'd met, whether I would have fallen in love with you and we would have lived happily together for the rest of our lives. That's how my mind works. I'm not driven by my libido, but I am a romantic.
Yeah, but you've just put that in romantic context, but it's basically saying that you're looking at her as an object of sex and intimacy rather than as an actress doing a role.
You really haven't been paying attention, have you, Seth? What I just said was the truth. Now, clear off, because I'm fed up with that sort of bargain basement level nonsense conversation. No, I'm a romantic.
Yeah. He's not a real Whovian anyway.
No.
It's not Doctor Who, it's the Doctor. And it's not a bloke, it's a Time Lord. How many hearts has he got, or she?
How many hearts has he or she got? Two, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I'm on my way. I've got three urethra.
Have you?
Yeah. Isn't that fantastic?
Gosh, how'd you organise that?
I just let it take care of itself. Right? I don't get involved.
Right.
I don't have to concentrate. I read once that there was somebody who, because they started concentrating on breathing, it became an obsession. Mm. And they were worried that if they didn't actually consciously breathe, they would die. That's an awful state to get into, isn't
Terrible.
It? Yeah. So I don't bother to try and involve myself in the functioning of my urethra.
No, but that is too many tubes.
Well, I've got... Apparently you're supposed to only have two. You knew that.
Right.
You have two. I think they connect your kidney, each kidney, into your bladder. But I
and
had
downwards, surely, as well.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know much about them.
Yeah.
They're quite a thin but important tube, right? It's the tube that can get scarred with kidney stones, which is very painful. And I've had those as well, and that's how they discovered it.
Oh, crikey.
Right, because I had a little tiny piece of calcium that was making its way down one of these tubes and scratching the surface as it went.
Nasty.
It was painful. And what they did was they made me take some sort of substance that colourised my urine. And they did an X-ray and they said, you've got a normal urethra on one side, but on the other side, you've got two urethra, but they're half the size of a normal one. Which is why if you get a tiny little bit of calcium moving from the kidney to the bladder, it's going to hurt like bilio. So
crikey.
But that doesn't make me Doctor Who, obviously.
No, but you could be one of his companions or her. Companions.
I could be a not so much a Time Lord, perhaps, as a Time Knave.
Certainly. Wonder which planet you're from.
I've always had a thing about Jupiter, partly because of the Holst. Da, da, da,
it's a good tune.
Da, da, da. Yeah. You, which planet would you be from?
Venus. Only because they have the best fashions and the miniskirts, the whole...
What?
Venus.
I don't get the miniskirts thing.
Oh, you weren't a Bananarama fan?
I was, actually.
I don't think you were paying attention, Tommy.
I wasn't listening to the lyrics.
Exactly. Oh, by the way, Neil Diamond. Girl.
Was it?
Yeah, and he wrote it.
You'll be a woman soon. I travelled down on the train from Birmingham to London once, having done a Saturday morning children's programme with Bananarama, just me and Bananarama. And that was just mesmerising.
Were they fun?
Yeah, they were just... They're still around, aren't they? In fact, they're coming back, as they say. Which planet are you from, Sam?
Mercury.
Because Mercury?
I don't know. First one pops me head.
Oh, right, OK. Who can do the planets and the order that they are?
Oh, my kids.
Yeah, because there's the phrase to remember it, isn't it?
Mnemonic. How does that go?
It's that my very eager mother just taught us the... Nine, and then it used to be planets, but...
My very eager mother...
Yeah, so Mercury, Venus, Earth...
Mars,
Jupiter.
Is Jupiter after Mars?
Yeah, I thought so.
What I like, the story I like, is that when... now, what was his name, the astronomer who discovered Uranus?
Oh, I know this.
Spanish dancing.
It's... Ian went to a school named after it, which was very unfortunate. Oh, bum. William Herschel.
Early onset, Kath.
Not even.
Herschel.
Yes.
That's right. Herschel was an emigre, and he wanted British citizenship. Right? So he figured... that if he named this planet he'd discovered after the King of England, he'd get British citizenship. This is from his little astronomy set-up in Kew. He found a planet and he thought, right,
how will I get use this information?
And he decided to call the planet George. Isn't that great? Wouldn't that have been great? But the astronomer royals got together and they said he has done very well, this German-Austrian chap. But we can't have any of this planet George. That would bring the whole notion of astronomy into disrepute. Instead, we'll give it a name that nobody will laugh at. We'll call it Uranus. That's a true story. I love it.
Incredible.
Thank you. And what's happened over the last 15 years, of course, is that people try to make out that it's pronounced Uranus. Which is almost as silly as Uranus.
Mm. Do you want to know something else that's silly?
Yes.
You said he discovered it in Kew. He didn't.
Oh, right.
He discovered Uranus in the Bath. In Bath.
Did he?
In his back garden.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
OK, I stand corrected. This was an outdoor bath, obviously.
It was the place, Bath.
Oh, I see, but he wasn't in the bath.
No, he was in his garden.
You see, if
there is a kind of joke there, isn't there? He was in Bath when he discovered Uranus.
In Bath. Oh, I see. Yes, there is. There is.
Maybe it only works in Yorkshire.
If I won the lottery, one of the things that I don't buy a ticket even, so it's not going to happen, but nevertheless, you have to start the notion with that phrase, if yes. I won the lottery. One of the things I've always wanted to do is have a bathroom in the top of the house with a glass ceiling.
Yes.
So that I could lie in the bath and watch the clouds, the night clouds, the white ones, scud by the moon. And I'd listen to... uplifting music and have a glass of red wine and that in the bath. That was what I would do if I won the lottery.
It's nice. You'd have to live in the middle of nowhere, though, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I see what you mean. What, because of the light pollution?
Well, and people peeping.
No, if it's the top of your house, they can't see down into your... I'd live somewhere where there are no box of flats overlooking.
Tell us.
The other thing I've always wanted to do, if I run the lottery, the other thing I'd do is, because I like horse racing, I'd buy about 10 racehorses, OK? And I'd name them, so they'd have to be foals when I bought them. And I'd call the first one a horse. And I'd call the second one another horse. And I'd call the third one yet another horse. Then I'd call the fourth one looks like a horse. And you see where I'm going with this?
Yep.
Then I'd enter them all in the same race.
Beautiful. You just want it for that one commentary.
Just that one commentary. I just want to hear the commentator deal with saying, and they're off. And the first to show is a horse, followed by another horse. And behind that is a horse, and then another horse, followed by, looks like a horse.
And yet another horse coming up on the outside.
Yeah. Where were we? A telephone number is
0344 499 1000.
Let's squeeze Julian in before we listen to the midnight news. Julian, you've got a couple of minutes. I hope that'll do you.
Hello, Tommy.
Julian.
How did you feel when you heard the sad news about the professor? Forget the doctor. We lost the professor this month.
Oh, you mean Stephen Hawking?
Yes.
Yeah. I hope he went peacefully, is how I felt. Mm. How about you?
Mm. Yeah, same. I knew him when he used to phone you up. And
I see. You're referring to a previous existence in which somebody had an electronic voice, which was new then.
It wasn't hard to do, was it?
No.
To imitate him once he had the program.
No. But very difficult to get any comedy out of it because you need inflection for comedy, and obviously his electronic voice lacked that.
Yet he was on The Simpsons, which is a very funny cartoon.
There's nothing funnier than The Simpsons, is there? You always get a proper belly laugh out of a Simpsons. What's your favourite Simpsons gag?
Oh, man, you put me on the spot.
I like the one when it was Scully and Mulder, and they connected Homer up to a lie detector, and they said, Homer, this machine will indicate whether or not you're telling the truth. Do you understand?
Yeah.
And Homer says yes, boom. And the machine implodes. Yeah. Great gag.
Oh, shit.
Great gag. Listen, we've hit the news, Julian, but I feel you've only just got into your stride. Do you want to hang on?
I'll hang on if you're willing.
And pick up after the news. Okay, my friend. Thanks. Thank you very much indeed for that. This is Tommy Boyd looking after the nighttime show on Talk Radio whilst Ian Lee is having a well-deserved break. Kathy's here and so is Sam. News time.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Tommy Boyd.
Tommy Boyd on Talk Radio.
On the programme this evening, Paul Ross will be here at 1 o'clock. On the programme this evening, we've been discussing Stephen Hawking, which we're discussing at the moment, gender pay disparity. We've been talking about Grenfell, and we've also been talking about UKIP, since it looks very much as though UKIP might be with us no longer in the not-too-distant future. But we return to Julian, who brought up the subject of Stephen Hawking just before the news. And, Julian, you only had a couple of minutes on air, and I felt that you hadn't quite got into your stride, so the floor is yours.
Thank you. Yeah, so I have fond memories of Stephen Hawking because of, as you said, the previous show and people phoning up pretending to be him. But also, I think most people will be surprised to learn that he was as old as he was. In a funny way,
yeah,
he looked younger than he actually was.
Do you know, now you mention it, you're absolutely right, and that had never occurred to me before.
They gave you 76, you know?
I wonder why that is.
I don't know. And the guy, I mean, it's not a good thing, but the guy had an affair. Like, he was a very... Well, he's a human being, and that shouldn't surprise us. But because he had all his physical capability taken away, it was sort of... I don't know, he's human like anyone else. He had an affair.
I can't work out... I can't work anything out unless I can write it down and add it up, right?
Uh-huh.
I'm just doing sums.
Okay.
If I had to work out, you know, that my train fare cost me £8.95 and the taxi was £5.40, but I gave £6. Am I allowed to claim back the tip on expenses? The only way I can work that out is if I write it down and go, okay, £5, carry one, £13.27. Now, he couldn't write anything down, could he, obviously, Stephen Hawking?
Well, he has a way of typing. I mean, that's all he...
But did he need that? I mean, whenever you see things like Goodwill Hunting and all those sorts of things where you get a genius, they always get a big blackboard, don't they? And they cover it with chalk things and X and ands and ampersands and blah and Y and brackets and ticks and square roots of.
there's a good Father Ted scene about that. If you've seen the one where the milk float has a bomb on it.
I've seen that one. And I don't know about the equation.
They're brainstorming ideas for how they can get Dougal safely off the milk float. And Ted is beavering away on the blackboard, his arms going up and down. You think he's writing some crazy equation. Then he flips it around and it just says in block capitals, "We put the brick on the accelerator."
yes.
So you need a blackboard to...
But how did Stephen Hawking come up with all those formulas then? He must have done it in his head.
All in his head, yeah. That's all
he needed. He kept it all in his head. Did he keep it all in his head, or did he actually find a way of twitching his right cheek, which was how he came to be able to create speech using that machine? By twitching his right cheek, he almost found a theory for everything.
I know. Incredible.
Here's another question, then. Do you think he'd have been such a genius if he hadn't been stricken with motor neuron disease?
Well, is it like the piano tuner who is normally, I can't remember if it's deaf or blind, but blind, aren't they? Because when you lose your sight, your ear tunes in to a greater level. So maybe he lost his physical capabilities and just gained something mental, or he had to.
Yes. You see, I don't know I hope it's not in any way disrespectful for people who are carrying conditions to have these conversations, but...
I hope not. I sense he would be open about it and joked about it. I know people said that he played practical jokes where he sort of pretended that his whole system had shut down or something.
What a character. Yes. Well, I think certainly a certain kind of intelligence is best betrayed by humour.
I mean, do you know what, Tommy? End of the month, I've got a stand-up comedy gig that I'm preparing for. Yeah, I've done a few. Very low-key, mainly sort of open mic stuff.
Right.
And this is sort of it's called like a live lounge event.
Okay, so how are you going to start?
It's before my birthday. So I'm inviting people down for my birthday.
Right.
So I'm going to sort of say thanks for coming for my birthday. What do you get a Jehovah's Witness for their birthday?
Wait a minute, can you broadcast this?
I don't know.
Well, then don't.
Let's leave it at that.
Kath's here, and I'll take the can for it. I don't think I want to hear the ending of the Jehovah's Witness joke on the radio.
Okay. Well, I mean, we've had some really crummy jokes. Maybe we should just quit while we're behind.
Understood. But that's my opening gambit. You asked me. That's my opening gambit.
Okay, you open with that. Right.
Yeah.
Well, good luck.
Thank you.
Well, send us a text with it, then. Can you do that whilst you're talking to us? Are you on your mobile phone?
What's the number?
It is 87222, and I am duty bound to tell you that will cost you 25p plus your standard message rate.
Okay.
Oh, you send the text to us with the joke.
And start your message with the word talk, not
87222.
Yeah.
Start your message with the word talk.
Yeah.
Okay.
You cool. Do that, and I'll tell Kath something because I'm a man, so I'll explain something. What shall I explain to you?
I don't know. Just start your sentence with actually or.
Actually. I worked as a stand-up comedian for a while.
Did you?
Yeah, I did, yeah. I was very well trained by a comedian called Tommy Trinder, who taught me some really good basics.
So I've just written the answer, talk, and then the answer.
Okay.
Thanks for your text to Talk Radio. It's probably not... Well, I'll let you...
What was the feed line again?
So the question is, what do you get a Jehovah's Witness for their birthday?
Gosh.
No, you can't tell that on the radio.
No, okay.
Not because it's offensive, just because it's crap.
Yeah.
I think it'll go down well as an opening gag, though.
It depends on the crowd.
Yeah, what time are you on and when do they start drinking?
I don't think many people will be drinking.
Oh, really?
No. It's not that sort of an event.
Oh. Is it a Jehovah's Witness convention?
No.
No, it's not. But, yeah, well, if you've got a better joke coming, or a different, what else...
I was advised...
Just because it's birthday-related.
Yeah, I was advised always get your first laugh as quickly as possible, otherwise the audience will begin to worry that they're going to be rubbish. Because audiences do feel that if they don't start laughing fairly soon, they're being rude at best.
Yeah.
Or worse, they're being stupid. So you've got to calm them down by getting your first laugh. Are you going to be coming on to the microphone?
Yeah.
I will do a fake trip. It always works.
Mm. Okay.
Just catch one of your feet. Catch your standing foot with the foot that's coming through.
Okay.
Right. And shall I tell you what makes it funny? Is as you sort of slightly stumble, you turn round and you point to the floor as if there's a nail sticking out. Because everybody knows that there isn't. And you've been clumsy.
You're justifying why
But because you're suggesting that the stage has been improperly maintained, then there's apparently the comedy lies in that. It's not so funny if you just trip. But if you trip and go and point and go, that's out of thing there.
Yeah, that's the blame. Yeah. There's the blame right there.
Then the other thing you do is get to the microphone and you can't take it. This one always works so well. So well. It's so cheap, but you get to the microphone on the stand and you can't get it off the clip.
Yeah.
So you struggle a bit and then suddenly you pull and you hit yourself on the forehead with a microphone and it goes boom.
Yeah. And I mean, that's very sort of Lee Evans. I think I'm much less low energy than that.
But you know, a laugh's a laugh.
That's true.
And so you've got two laughs now and you haven't said anything.
Well, thank you.
Strongly recommend it.
Much appreciated. Well, I'll try and get a Stephen Hawking joke in as well. I'm not sure.
Which one's that you're going to tell?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm thinking about... Oh, no, I don't know. I don't know if I should say them on radio.
No, I wouldn't. I'm guessing.
Yeah. I mean, it's a venue where I can sort of go sort of close to the knuckle, maybe more so than I would on here.
Yeah,
I was thinking... Yeah.
And yet drink won't be taken.
No, drink won't be taken, no.
And yet it's an event where you can go quite close to the knuckle.
Yeah, I know.
Because drink helps...
Maybe you can't, maybe I shouldn't. It's a strange one. I'll let you know how it goes.
Please do. Thanks for your call.
Thank you, Tommy.
Kind of want to see that now, don't you?
The act, his act.
Yeah.
Have you ever thought about, you must have thought about doing some stand-up comedy.
Yeah, I did. And I almost did it. But at the time, because I started doing some comedy writing I used to do a show that was a satirical show, and I used to do all the female voices. I used to do all these different, and you know, it was more miss than hit, but we had a go, and that's kind of half the game, isn't it? We were doing it every single day, and we had a laugh.
Sorry, where is this? On a stage somewhere or a radio station?
When I used to work at Three Counties, I used to work with a guy called Ronnie Barber. You actually worked on Talk Radio for a while.
I know that name, I can see him now. Picture him now.
He's wonderful.
Very nice man.
He's wonderful. And I'd done a lot of straight journalism and I'd had my own shows and stuff. I was working on Breakfast, co-hosting Breakfast at one point. But on the side, I was writing sketches for him, for his show. And in the end, I jumped ship from Breakfast because it wasn't making me happy. And what made me happy was working on his show. And I worked on it for about 2-3 years. Mm-hmm. And during the course of that, we started writing radio plays and all kinds of things. And I started to wonder, I was encouraged, in fact, by some really brilliant people to start sending scripts off and doing all that kind of stuff. But for a while, I thought that was the way my career was going to go. But by the time things started to move for me, I was very pregnant.
Ah.
So although I should have turned that into a thing, but it's not massively helpful being, you know, 8 months pregnant and working late nights and doing comedy clubs and things.
No.
It's kind of... I couldn't have done it when I was younger.
No.
And the timing was wrong when I was old enough.
Hmm.
But never mind.
But you've made people laugh.
Yeah, I do it in a different way now. I don't think I could do stand-up. Write for someone else.
You could write for someone else, yes. It does take a lot of cojones, because if you sing a song, people will applaud at the end of it, even if you're very, very indifferent. So you never die as a singer. But as a comedian, you can tell about 90 seconds in when the audience are starting to get uncomfortable with the fact that they are not going to laugh at anything you're going to do.
Awful.
Because the thought has already gone through their head. I wonder if we're just going to not laugh at anything this young man or woman does. And once that thought goes through their head, you are absolutely sunk.
Yeah.
And you have to, as the man says, sing a song and get off. And I died twice. And it was a good thing because that's the worst thing that can happen to you. Oh, no, actually, it's not. No, I died twice, but I was also attacked on stage twice.
Oh, were you?
Yes, I was attacked on stage in the Bearcat Club in Twickenham. I was one of the first ever alternative acts there. And I was doing Dr. Ingeborg Bingabonga, your friendly sex doctor.
Oh, wow.
And I was asking for improvised sex problems from members of the audience.
Wow.
When this bloke just came marching up on the stage and he said, "I'm with my girlfriend and we ain't come here to listen to stuff like this." And so he put me in a headlock and pulled me off stage and they all cheered. Not because they wanted the comedy to end, but because it was a great thing to see.
Did they think it was part of the bit?
They just were enjoying it. They were drunk. They were drunk. And the second time I was in Brighton doing something about football, I was telling jokes about football, about Brian Clough, who was the then Brighton manager, and I was saying jokes like, not particularly funny, but like, have you met that Brian Clough? I went to see him in his office. So simple. Four mirrors and a throne. That sort of thing.
Right.
And I said, they're playing Antwerp in the Cup next week. He went to see Antwerp play. He didn't take the ferry. He walked. You know, that sort of thing. And all of a sudden, I was aware of this bloke just walking up the aisle towards me. And I thought, oh, don't take it personally, mate, please. And then he turned at the stage and walked along the front of the stage down in the pit and then started coming up the stairs.
Oh, blimey.
And I'm thinking, it's going to happen. It's going to happen. And he just got to me and just threw a punch.
Wow.
What do you do? I did sort of a
dodge. Mate.
Well, he wasn't that big. And right. So it crossed my mind to actually... Have a go back. Yeah, because I'm from Feltham, so I'm reasonably sort of well-versed in sort of low-grade martial arts.
Right. So the fight or fright thing with you would go fight, would it?
Mm. Yes, it would. I can't run anymore, so...
I might as well have a swing.
Option about it, really. Our telephone number, we've got another 45 minutes before it's Paul Ross, but if you want to talk to myself, Kat and Sam, it is...
0344 499 1000.
Let's go to Martin. Now, Martin called last night, and if you were listening to the programme, you will remember that Martin had a series of issues and difficulties which he had taken to MI5, and he was kind enough to play us the conversation that he'd recorded between himself and MI5, in which a very helpful MI5 operative, who gave the name Gabby, was extremely helpful and supportive and directed Martin towards the kind of organisations that might stand a better chance of helping him than MI5. But I did ask Martin to keep us posted on how things went for him, and he's been kind enough to call back with an update. So... good morning, Martin.
Ah, OK, thank you very much, Tommy, for having me on the show. I do appreciate it. Actually, the bit about the comedian, I did want to be a comedian.
A lot of people do, time. Yeah.
But I'm not too sure.
No.
But, you know, you've got to be funny, haven't you?
It does help.
It'd be nice to be a comedian, though. It'd be lovely. But, sorry to distract from what I was trying to say, but I was going to say, I phoned the FCO, Tommy.
The Foreign Commonwealth Office?
Yeah. Do you want to hear it?
Well, do I? You tell me. Do I want to hear it? What do you think?
I think it'd be good.
How long is it?
It's only 3 minutes.
So this is you phoning the Foreign and Commonwealth Office when?
Today.
All right. Oh, so you started making phone calls, self-contained phone calls to contribute to phone-in programmes. I like it.
Okay.
This could catch on, couldn't it?
I don't know.
All right, so set the scene then. What time of day is it? And how did you decide what number to ring? And what did you think that you would say or get out of them?
Well, from what you said yesterday, sorry, I just thought, you know, I went to see the doctor, like you said, but they put me on a really long waiting list.
That's what happens nowadays. Don't take that personally.
So I thought, what can I do? So I thought, I was I'll phone the FCO and just see what they have to say, because obviously I rang not maybe the best place yesterday.
Can I just give the listener who might not have been listening last night a quick thumbnail of what your problem is?
Okay.
Martin told us last night that he had been teaching in Indonesia. He married an Indonesian woman who then disappeared. Martin said that he had contacted the police in Indonesia and they didn't want to do anything about it. And he also contacted, I think he said, the British consulate in Indonesia and they advised him to go home and not talk about this anymore.
Yeah.
Which was what led Martin to believe that there was something being covered up, which was why he telephoned MI5. And at the end of our chat last night, I suggested that a good thing to do might be to go to his GP and just talk about how he feels at the moment and see whether he can get some help there. So you tried that.
Yeah.
You've got an appointment, like I said to you, probably in August.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, you phoned the FCO. So, OK, let's take a listen.
OK.
Phone the Foreign Commerce Office.
Hello, and thank you for calling the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. For advice on overseas travel, please visit www.gov.uk and search for Foreign Travel Advice. If you are calling about an emergency involving a British person abroad, press 1. To speak with an operator, please hold. Your conversation with the operator may be monitored and/or recorded for security and training purposes.
Good afternoon, you're speaking to the Tanwan Wireline. My name is Brian. How can I help you?
Hi, Brian. Nice to speak to you. Thank you. Oh, it was Brian. I was hoping that you might be able to help me or point me in the right direction, if you don't mind, sorry.
Okay.
Brian, what happened was, I was living in Indonesia, okay?
Right.
Now, my wife, she went missing.
Right.
I reported it to the police. And I reported it to the FCO.
Okay.
And the consulate at the time.
Right.
However, at that time, I had to go to another police station and reported it to the main head office.
Okay.
Now, the thing is, Brian, I've not had much luck with this case, though. So I called the United Nations to help me look for my wife.
Right.
Is there any help that the FCO can do in terms of liaising with anybody at all, even the UN, to help locate what happened?
To be honest with you, sir, you're through to the switchboard of the FCO.
Right.
If you have a department that I can put you through, I can put you through to help you to assist on that matter.
Okay.
You see,
missing people it would be, I suppose, Brian.
I tell you one thing you could do, sir, is that if you go onto the gov.uk website.
I've got impaired vision.
Oh, you've got impaired vision, sorry.
This has caused me a lot of problem before, yeah.
Uh-huh.
It's hard for me to find information.
I understand. Let me see. Okay.
All right, thank you, Brian.
Is he away for long, Martin?
Sorry?
Is he away for long?
No, he's just getting me in touch with the, the specialist.
I'll put the CT, sir, to our specialist contact center.
where you may be able to help you with this.
Oh, thank you very much.
Sir. Okay. Yeah,
thank you very much, sir.
Okay. Good night.
Thank you.
The Lady Killers.
Please listen carefully to the following messages. For visa and passport services, press 1. For consular services for British nationals, press 2. If you know the extension number you wish to call, press 9 and wait for the prompt.
No digit has been selected.
Welcome to the British Consulate. Please listen carefully to the following messages. For visa and passport services, press 1.
I'll tell you what, Martin, whilst we're listening to the options on the switchboard, which will probably take until August in itself, we'll pay the rent at this end and then get back to you. This is Tommy in for Ian Lee.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Tommy Boyd.
Tommy Boyd on Talk Radio.
We've got Martin on the line, whose wife went missing in Indonesia some time ago, and he's beavering away trying to find out what happened. Martin, you there?
I'm sorry, yeah. Thanks,
yeah, okay.
Tommy, yeah.
Yeah, that's all right. Don't play any more of that tape, but thank...
He's got back to me in a second, though. Listen.
No, hang on.
Press 2. For notarial services, press 3. For births and marriages...
Martin, I'd rather just talk to you for a second, if that's possible.
Press 5.
Martin!
Sorry.
I'd rather talk to you... Because you said it was couple of minutes, and it was nearly 7.
Oh, was it? Sorry.
Yeah, so try and get your timings right.
It's hard to...
We can't take up the whole show with it. I mean, we need to cut to the chase, you know, get to the action,
well,
the nitty-gritty.
To the end of the recording, then.
No, you tell me what happens.
She just hung up on me.
Right. OK, Martin, you're obviously not getting anywhere, are you?
No.
How long ago did this happen, that your wife went missing in Indonesia?
2013.
So 5 years ago?
Yeah.
How long had you been married?
10 years.
10 years, and she's an Indonesian?
Yeah.
And what do you think happened?
Well, we kind of know what happened, but I didn't want to go into too much detail there because I was told not to talk about it.
By whom?
By the Foreign and Commonwealth Office.
Well, you can tell me I'm not Foreign and Commonwealth.
Well, our house was firebombed. We were attacked by Muslims, and I lived as a Muslim for 10 years... But because I was a foreigner, they attacked me and they raped my wife and they took her away from me.
OK, well, that's a pretty harrowing thing to be carrying around all these years. What happened in the aftermath of what you say happened?
I was taken to the embassy.
By?
By the consulate and the foreign embassy. I went to the embassy in Singapore.
I see.
And that's where they gave me my instructions.
Right, and you think that your wife is dead?
I don't know. I can't get a death certificate for her, no matter what I do.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, you're going to keep trying, aren't you?
I don't know what else to do.
Well, you could stop trying.
I mean,
that is the only alternative, isn't it? There is no alternative to trying other than stop trying.
And then what?
Well, as Hamlet says, the rest is silence, I know, but if you're not likely to achieve something, a really good idea is to stop trying and try to do something else.
I'm still married, though. I don't want to get married again and be like polygamy or something.
OK, well... It's not polygamy, but that doesn't matter.
What's it called? Yeah. But
bigamy.
I asked the...
it's called bigamy.
Oh, bigamy, okay. Well, it's not good anyway, is it?
No, but if your wife is deceased, it wouldn't be... Look, that doesn't matter. I'm just concerned for you because I can tell that it's eating you up, and I would quite understand that in anybody, to have that series of recollections in your mind...
Yeah, sorry.
And over time, we can actually start to adjust them accidentally or on purpose so that they suit the frame of mind that we want to be in whenever we have those recollections. Are you kind of following me?
Yeah, maybe.
And it might not be doing you any good.
Mm. I want to go home, Tommy.
That's changing the subject slightly. I'm worried about how things are inside your own head. How do you think things are inside your own head?
In terms of what, sorry?
Well, what sometimes gets described as mental health. And it's something that we should all be aware of in ourselves all the time.
It makes it very difficult, you know, just to carry on normally when you think that, you know, you've been told just to forget about the whole of your life.
But do you think you're thinking well?
In what respect?
Well, do you think you're thinking well? Are you making good decisions?
I feel that the decision was taken out of my hands.
Because I would just say that from yesterday, when you decided telephone MI5 with your problem, you know, I'm going to be blunt. You would respect that.
Yeah, yeah.
You were very much wasting your time.
Yeah, yeah.
So what was your real reason for phoning MI5 if you knew that you were wasting your time?
Because I just felt I had to do something, you know?
Yeah, but not waste other people's time, surely. With the best will in the world, I thought the person that you spoke to on the switchboard at MI5 was ever so sympathetic, but it was very clear to all of us, before it became clear to you, what she was saying, which was that you had called the wrong organisation.
Right.
But you wanted somebody to listen. So that leads me to wonder whether you have got somebody in your life who listens.
Okay, I see what you mean.
So I'm asking the question, have you got people in your life who listen?
No.
Ah. So what we can end up doing, if we're not careful, if that's the case, if we haven't been able to cultivate that kind of social network, is to end up phoning MI5, which is not quite right, is it?
Well, I think what's not right is to take somebody within a matter of weeks from one life. I had a job, I had a home.
Now, let's stay with where we are at the moment, which is how you are.
And suddenly they take it off me and they say, we have to keep it quiet.
I'm not going to go there.
£10 worth of trade going into
Indonesia. I'm not going there.
I'm not covering up criminals, Tommy.
I'm not going to be distracted into where you want me to be distracted.
Oh, come on then, sorry.
I'm staying with where you are. And how you are.
Right.
And what you've got to help you.
Oh, yeah. Okay, thanks.
What's the date you've got for your appointment with your GP?
Well, I spoke to him today, actually.
I know. You said. I heard. And what's the date you've got?
No, but what? The counselling, you mean? Well, they said you need counselling because you've had to go through such a trauma.
This was on the phone to your GP today?
And they put me on a waiting list.
No, that wouldn't have happened. You'd have seen a GP first.
They put me on a waiting list. That's
No, they wouldn't have referred you to counselling unless you'd seen a GP. Did you speak to a GP?
I spoke to the people from the social support team.
That's not your GP, is it? Have you got a doctor?
Yeah, I've got a doctor, yeah.
That's who you need to speak to first.
Right.
So you didn't speak to your doctor today?
Well, I spoke to the social support team.
Which is the same as not speaking to your doctor?
I went into the doctor's, though.
Oh, you went into your doctor's now?
Yeah. And I spoke on the phone to the social support team.
Which is... And the doctors gave you... The doctor's surgery gave you an appointment to visit a GP?
Well, they also asked about the counselling and they said that it's
And what's the date of your appointment with your GP?
26th of March is another appointment, I think.
There's another appointment, you think?
Mm.
Okay. Well, as soon as those events kick in, and you've done very well to get an appointment as adjacent as March the 26th, it speaks well of the NHS in the Liverpool area. Martin, then... Good. Get back to us and keep us posted. Meantime, good luck and look after yourself.
Oh, thank you very much. Okay, sure.
Night-night.
Thank you.
Night-night. Because whilst we were listening to in a commercial break, Kath did say to me, I'm not sure whether he actually would have been to a GP.
Seemed very quick.
Did seem very quick. It's an interesting one, isn't it? Interesting that with such a set of recollections in his mind, that in order to get somebody to listen, he has to phone a national radio station or MI5.
Or NATO.
NATO was it as well?
NATO was mentioned, yeah.
And the United Nations.
Yeah.
You see, I mean, is this about the breakdown of the community?
I think it might be.
I hope you wouldn't mind us talking in these terms, broad terms, issue terms, mm-hmm. about his situation, because I don't want to be too talking about him without his presence in any specific way.
No, I'm sure he's listening. And that is a lot to carry since 2012.
It certainly is. It certainly is. But you see, when we all lived in villages, all 200 of us knew, all 200 of us, a little cough there, friends. And, you know, if somebody was starting to have some difficulties with the way they were processing a series of events, however true or not true those events are, then there would be a network of people there to help bring you back onto the straight and narrow. But he said he hadn't got that at all, and that he's visually impaired. Well, I hope we can help. What else can you do? OK, Paul Ross will be along in 10 minutes, I hope, because it's always nice to have him in the studio to tell us a little bit about how the evening, or morning rather, is going to unfold on his Through the Night show. But in the meantime, it's 20 to 1. It's Tommy here, looking after things for Ian Lee, with Kath and with Sam. It is Talk Radio.
The Tommy Boyd Radio Experiment.
Tommy Boyd on Talk Radio.
Sorry, I'm just telling Kath a joke about the time that I thought I might have breast cancer.
Oh.
I know. It was crazy. Since we were talking to that last caller, Martin, Kath and I, and I'm sure Sam as well, have just been coming round to doing that sort of honesty thing where you talk about your own... I'm not saying Martin was in any way hypochondriacal, but I can be hypochondriacal, less so now than I used to be when I was young. But if ever I read about an ailment, I would suddenly start to develop all the symptoms of it, whatever it was.
Whereas I'm the opposite, really.
Really?
Yeah.
How resilient.
Yeah, I'll always think, no, I'll be all right.
So you wouldn't go to the doctor?
No, not until things start dropping off.
No, I make a point of not going to the doctor very often. I like to be one of those people who doesn't bother the doctor.
Yeah, I'm even though at the point where it takes an awful lot for me to take a pill for a headache or anything. Because I feel like I need to know what's going on.
And yet when the word went out from the James Whale team this evening, does anyone in the building have any paracetamol?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I work with someone who suffers with migraines.
Ah.
So I have a little pack of Nurofen in my bag at all times.
Funnily enough, I had to clear the empty silver tray of Nurofen off the presenter's desk when I arrived to set up, and here it is. So you don't use them very often then, but it's an empty packet now.
I don't
so
use them myself.
Them in nine, you don't use them yourself at all?
No, they're what I shove in Ian's direction when he starts to go.
Uh-huh.
See, if he gets a migraine, it's game over. He's thrown up in bins and having to lie on the floor and all kinds.
Oh, jeez. Have you ever had a migraine?
No.
No? Sam, have you ever had a migraine?
Not to my knowledge, no.
No, only once me. I think it was a migraine. It was a Friday night, and I was due to present a children's programme called The Wide Awake Club the following Saturday morning. And I was staying in a hotel, but my very good friend Michaela Strachan said, why don't you come round to my flat, and since you're on your own, and we'll have a plate of pasta and a gossip about everyone we work with.
Brilliant.
So, yeah, it was great. So I did that. I had half a bottle of wine, maybe a little bit more than that, but easy for me. And since I had to be up at 4 a.m, I thought, you know, a couple of glasses of wine will help me nod off.
Yeah, exactly.
Got back to the hotel, went to bed. Following morning, alarm went off, woke up. Oh, God, 4 a.m. I got swung out of the bed, went to put the kettle on in the hotel room to make myself a cup of tea, and the room just started to swirl. And then I felt not sick, but nauseous. Can't explain it. And lights and various things. They'd sent a car for me, and it was outside, so I managed to pull some clothes on, and I got into the cab, and it drove me to the TV studios. And when I got there, I just said, I can't do it. I don't know what this is. And so they called the studio doctor, who's a lovely chap who often appears on air, called Dr. Hillary.
Yes.
A really nice guy. And he had to ask the question. I was in my a dressing room, and I was really feeling, you know, I couldn't sit bolt upright or anything. He had to say to me, and that's fair enough, he said, were you drinking last night? And, you know, I was able to say to him, yes, but I can drink. And this is not a terrible hangover. Mm-hmm. I don't get them. So it's not that, it's something else. Anyway, in the end, he said, well, I think you've got a lightning migraine attack. He said, the only worry is if it's something that's going to be set in now or whether it's going to be a one-off, because that does happen. Well, that was 25 years ago. I got a taxi all the way home, which was 60 miles. And the next day I just felt exhausted.
Yeah.
But I'm touching wood like crazy telling this story because I don't want one of those again. So how frequent are Ian's?
It varies. But, yeah, I'd say once every three... He hasn't had one, touch wood, for a long while.
And that's Formica, by the way, but anyway.
Well, is there any wood anywhere?
That's what I'm looking for. There's no wood anymore.
But he goes through, they sort of cluster together. So probably about 6 months ago, there were a few in a row.
Poor lad.
Horrible.
Has he had them from an early age?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
I think so.
My wife used to get them, but they burned out.
Isn't that
again,
weird?
Touch formica.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say touch formica instead of...
Does she struggle with planes and things? With pressure in her ears and things like that?
No,
all
not
right.
As far as I know.
I think, because we joke about it, Ian and I, that he seems to have a... Something loose around his sort of ears and the front of his head, because he's very sensitive to, you know, air pressure and stuff like that. And I wonder whether it's connected to the migraines.
They still don't really know what migraine is, do they?
No,
I don't use the they thing very often, but I mean doctors, obviously, surgeons, whatever. Sam, you've never had a migraine attack or anything similar?
No, don't think so.
No. And, of course, then there's Jane, when she used to have them, she used to try checking what she'd eaten for about 48 hours before and then eliminating all of that.
No cheese, no chocolate, all that stuff.
Cheese and chocolate. Yep. But what I wanted to say to him was, the doc, was, OK, let's hope it's a one-off, but what triggered it? How come? Why? Because do you know what it felt like to me? More than anything else, it felt like a manifestation.
Right.
It felt like a visit. I felt that something was on me. I honestly feel if I got that big, tall priest out of The Exorcist and he'd come in, I would have thrown up green pea soup all over him, but he would have told the spirit to go away.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it felt like to me.
Gosh.
I felt like something jumped on me and got his claws in around my head. So when it happens to him, then he knows that he's spark out and...
Yeah, but he normally feels it coming on, and then we get the studio really cold, and sometimes he'll have sugar, and I always have the pills to hand. We zap
Do they
it.
Help?
Yeah.
Regular painkillers help?
Yeah. If you get it early enough, and he's got used to...
He knows when
the
it's...
The warning signs, yeah.
Right. Right.
That temperature, bit of sugar... He tends
needs to
know.
Be cool.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's too hot, and is it in any way linked to diet as far as he knows? He must have tried lots of different...
Tried all sorts.
I'm going to not eat that for 6 months. I'm going to not eat that.
It's a mystery. It's a mysterious thing.
It are. Well, Paul will be along shortly to give us the briefing on his show. He's looking more and more like William Shatner, isn't he?
There is something of the Shatner.
Have
about
you noticed
him,
that?
Yeah.
Am I the only person who's noticed that Paul Ross is looking more and more like Shatner the younger? Let's get him to do a little bit of Shatner, shall we?
I'm sure he can.
Because to be Bill Shatner in Star Trek, all you have to do is pause in the wrong place in a sentence.
Yes.
Sorry, were you doing a visual impression of Bill Shatner?
Yeah.
Do it again, because it's terrific radio.
It's kind of, right, the way he speaks is like the top of a castle battlement.
Yes.
oh, no, it's going to go horribly wrong.
Yeah, so if the line is, Mr. Spot, that's ridiculous, he does it as, Mr. Spot, that's ridiculous.
Yes.
And it's his own way of acting.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw the film that he was in that got him the gig on Star Trek. He plays a racist lawyer.
Wow.
In an Alabama town.
Right.
And he's doing it there and then. He's still doing it. It's his own technique for acting.
He and in latter years, that's it led to something of a resurgence for Shatner, hasn't it? He's been in some... Well, he was in that legal thing. Oh, God, I've gone again.
Early onset.
Yeah, not even.
No.
Anyway.
Anyway.
It's become his thing. Bill Shatner is Bill Shatner and people love it.
Oh, God, yes. Yes, yes, yes.
What is that thing he's in as the lawyer?
Well, I am not having early onset. I don't know because I don't watch television.
Oh, man.
Well, I used to. That's how come I watch, you know, Star Trek and everything.
What was the last series you watched?
I did watch a bit of House of Cards and I enjoyed that for the performance both of the woman who played Robin, who was Forrest Gump's girlfriend in Forrest Gump.
Forrest Gump. Is it Robin Wright Penn?
Something like that, mm-hmm. Yeah. She's a tremendous actress and an actor, sorry, and also a very good director. But now I feel as though I've almost done something almost illegal by having been a fan of Kevin Spacey.
Okay. I think a lot of people were
Spacey,
fan.
Sorry.
I think a lot of people rated Kevin Spacey. That doesn't make you complicit in what happened.
No, but, you know, in the sort of the whole panoply of things, you're supposed to be able to notice or identify
pick out
that
wrong
somebody...
Him.
Yeah, you're supposed to go, oh, well, I've always thought that Kevin Spacey was, you know, you never married, did he, you know, and that sort of thing.
Mm.
But, yeah, I watched that and I enjoyed that. But I fall out of... I fall out of love with those great long box sets things much more quickly than the average person. That doesn't make me more better than the average person. I just have a low threshold of concentration.
I can't really be doing... I think it's probably down to the hours I work and the fact that I'm knackered all the time. Mm. But I can't commit to long series. And the Americans have got this thing at the moment of just... It's this never-ending series.
Yeah.
And if there isn't an end in sight, that doesn't give me much hope, you know.
Yeah, and they do things like they kill off characters who... You watch for 8 or 9 hours and somebody is absolutely central to the whole thing.
Yeah.
And then he or she is killed.
Uh-huh.
And you think, well, that should be the ending then.
And then by series 4, it's a completely different show.
Yes, it is. It is. It's like in, is it old No Country for Old Men, that extraordinary film with, now I'm having one of them now.
Javier Bardem, isn't it?
That's the man. Well done. What an extraordinary creature he is. But... Long before the ending of it, you think the thing's all about that cowboy called Llewellyn who discovers $2 million that's left as a drug deal that's gone wrong. You assume he's the hero, and yet he's dead just after halfway in the movie. It's good to get Paul in on this because he knows more about film than anybody else.
Oh, of course he does. He won't be missing out names like we are.
Two things we've got going here, Paul. The first one is how much you're looking these days like the young William Shatner.
Oh,
are you aware of that?
I was not. No, but that's
no.
Crazy
next thing. Time you see him, you see yourself in a mirror. Just say something.
Is that James Tiberius Kirk or a T.J. Hooker?
The former of
okay,
the two.
Okay, few.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, put the pause in the wrong place in a sentence, which is what he does. But what are we talking about? We're talking about the American box craze for boxed sets, and well, we don't have time, do we, to watch?
I must say, I'm a terror because when I was doing the breakfast show, I had a lot of time during the day.
Ah.
And I should have been doing something like reading a bit more. I mean, yes. I could read a fair bit, but I watched the all 5 series of Breaking Bad via Netflix, I think in 3 weeks, which is a rather chilling admission, isn't it? But once I got into it, and of course, there's a bit of a misnomer with these an hour of Breaking Bad, they're only about 44 minutes.
Right,
and
yeah.
the way they construct the story arc, of course, is they always leave you wanting more. And normally you wait a week. In the old day, when I was young, you wait a week, now you can just go straight into it. It's instant gratification,
and
isn't it?
And the technology, I've only seen this, I've not been caught up by it, but I can see how it catches you up. You watch one episode and then you don't have to get up or even touch the remote. What happens is a clock comes up and says the next episode will start in 14, 13, 12. How can you not?
And also, of course, the Netflix, and most of the people with boxes, they take out the air brakes anyway.
Yeah.
So you're not sitting there for the dull bits. In fact, a couple of years ago, Clive James wrote a very good, very slim guide, because he'd been a great TV critic in the 70s for The Observer and knows his films and movies. He wrote a great guide to the best box sets. It would be outdated slightly now, but he put, I think, The Sopranos, which I love, was his favourite.
Yeah.
Game of Thrones he really rated, which I'd gone off a little. It's still great, but I went off the last series a bit. Breaking Bad was good, and he also liked The Wire. I mean, The Wire's fantastic as well, I think.
But with them, you know, if you're a buff, you can watch a movie 10 times. What film have you seen most often, would you say, Paul?
Probably either... My favourite film of all time is The Wild Bunch. Singing in the Rain's up there. Lawrence of Arabia, yeah. I must have seen 20, 24 times.
Yeah. And you could... and you
Godfathers, I've seen.
And you're going to watch it again, aren't you?
Whenever I, if ever it's on, and like with Patton, Lust for Glory, I can watch it at any point in the film, but I have to watch it to the end. So if it's 20 minutes in, I'm still there 2 hours later. If it's an hour and 20, and I'm there for another hour.
And are you just, you know, the comfort thing of knowing what's coming next, yeah. or are you actually spotting things that you didn't spot before, or a bit of both?
It's more the former. It's more that sense of I'm not going to be... It's like rereading a favourite poem. Yeah, you're not going to be disappointed.
But do people watch these box sets over and over?
Actually, that's an interesting one. No, I don't think you can. I mean, the other one I loved a few years ago was West Wing, but I'd never make that journey again. And I like the American House of Cards, but I wouldn't make that journey again. I loved the journey when I was on it, and they were great and sat at the time, brilliantly acted, well-crafted. But you're right, they're not repeat views in the way that great movies are.
How do they end these box sets? Because a movie ends, doesn't it? A movie's almost always got an ending. Somebody dies or a resolution occurs.
Well, I must say, Breaking Bad, and if people are wading through it now, Breaking Bad's final episode was absolutely astonishing. And a really satisfying resolution. Mm. One of the series dipped a bit, three or four, I think, dipped a bit. The final of that was brilliant. The final Sopranos left it, it was quite chilling but slightly open-ended. Some of them, though, unfortunately, are suddenly not commissioned anymore. So they set up these amazing premises or characters and then it, like, lost. What went on there? That was about a month of my life I'll never get back.
I think I started... There were two series with Lost, and I'll keep going. And then when I realised that America was too ahead of us, I can't be dealing with this.
No.
I gave up.
And there was not a bad one a while ago. I can't remember.
Homeland was another one.
Homeland, but Homeland's gone on way too long.
I loved the first series of Homeland. They should have left it at that. It was perfect.
And 24 went on too long, didn't it? It was called 24 Hours. It should have been the perfect first series. Forget about it.
But is it a bit like buying a lottery ticket as well, which I don't do, but I know lots of people who think, well, I've been buying a lottery ticket now for 10 years using the same numbers. I've got to keep buying it, because otherwise next week, the week I don't buy it, you know, I've got that commitment.
Well, I waded through, and I urge everybody not to get involved in it. It was dire after the first series. I watched all four or five seasons, get me, I'm American, of Sons of Anarchy.
Right.
And it's the American biker. Ron Perlman in it, Charlie Hunnam, who's a great young British actor who's been in American things. But actually, it came in there just irritatingly contrived and irritating. You could see where it was all going, and they were all unpleasant people. But I thought, I've watched 3.5 series, I've got to watch to the end.
Isn't the remote fantastic for being able to blow something out of the water? You just put, you go, right, I've had enough of this, and you point that big old remote at, just like Elvis, and bow!
Clank, that's it, you're gone.
Kath and Sam and I will see you tomorrow night. Stand by for Paul.